high atop the skyline of downtown Chicago to 38 states and Canada. Your host for this evening, Justin Kaufman.
Good evening and welcome. 312-981-7200 is our phone number tonight. We got lots to do, so we'll get right to it. Coming up on the program, lots of conversation about the Chicago Transit Authority, whether or not crime can be deterred by adding more police or possibly adding back the conductors. John Greenfeld from Streets Blog Chicago is going to join us a little bit later to talk about that and some other issues when it comes to transportation. This is a big issue, and it continues to make headlines every time we see some sort of crime that happens on the CTA. The CTA will tell you that crime has been down since 2019. But when you really start to parse out some of the details, especially when it comes to petty crime, it's doubled, especially since 2015 and the advent of rideshare. So why is that? And could it be possibly deterred by adding human beings to the train? We've talked about this a little bit last week. John is suggesting the same thing and actually kind of going through the numbers to see how you would be able to put more human beings on the trains instead of more police presence. If you have not been a customer on the CTA or a rider, you maybe don't know that at a certain point in the 90s, they discontinued having conductors on the train. They went to an automated system. It was a cost-cutting move, so you weren't going to pay $5 a ride. But in that time, over time, gradually, we've seen crime on the uptick. And the question is does the CTA have to think about putting some of those bodies back on? John Greenfield will join us coming up in the 7:30 segment. A little bit later in the program, the Spertus Museum has been doing critical conversations. It's an annual event that they produce at the Spertus Institute for Jewish Learning, which is on South Michigan Avenue. And they bring together around a topic. This year, it's climate change. And they have some really big names, environmentalists, coming to town. And one of which is Kevin Green. Kevin Green is a behavioral scientist at heart. And so much has been made about awareness when it comes to climate change, right? We've heard so much about we need to know more about what's happening. We need to, almost it becomes a political fight to get to the hearts and minds. But when it gets to our behaviors, my behavior, your behavior, we don't really change. Maybe we reluctantly get into something that we know is good for the planet, like recycling, or in my case, maybe a shorter hot shower. But we don't. Because we look at that issue and we say, there's nothing we really can do. How can I stop an ocean from rising? How can I keep greenhouse gases out of the air from my little Honda? Well, this is what Kevin is, the next phase of climate change. He's a behavioral scientist, and they're bringing that science to trying to change behaviors and routines in human beings. Impossible, right? We're going to talk to him coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. He's really dedicated his life to this, and we'll talk about what are some of the things that you really have to do when you're asking human beings to change. It'll be a good conversation. 312-981-7200. Also coming up tonight, Ted McClellan is back. He is our linguist. He is also my co-host when it comes to the Chicago Accent Challenge. That's right. If you've got a great Chicago accent, if people have said to you, hey, you know what? You really sound like a Chicago. You sound like one of those super fans. 312-981-7200. Your accent may win you a prize. And what a perfect day to do it, because tomorrow is Fat Tuesday. And we'll ask you this question. How do you pronounce the little Polish donuts with the jelly inside that you eat on Fat Tuesday? I'm not going to pronounce it for you. I'm not going to give you a heads up. How do you pronounce it? That'll be one of the questions coming up in the 9 o'clock hour with Ted McClellan. And 10 o'clock, Sammy Penyanovich will be here. Big day in Chicago sports, Chicago Blackhawks at the trade deadline. Of course, shopping Robin Leonard. We just heard Chris Bowden and Rowe talking about it. And of course, the internet hasn't been too kind to the Blackhawks today. But that's not the only story in Chicago sports. The NFL Combine is beginning. The Chicago Bears, of course, looking to be active participants in the Combine to see who they may draft for next year. Also, the Chicago Bulls have been rumored to be in the market for a new GM. Right after the All-Star game, the big stories that were coming out, anonymous sources, is that the Bulls we're going to move on from Gar Forman. So we'll talk about that. And spring training. Oh, my gosh. How is it that we are in February? The Cactus League has begun. And that's the fourth story on the list. The big story for me is who's going to lead off for either of these teams? Rossi is talking about Chris Bryant, perhaps. The White Sox are saying, what about Yoan Moncada? Two great hitters who have rarely played in that number one spot. So 312-981-7200. We'll do all that coming up. Good to be here. Just flew in from New York City today. If you're listening to the program last week, you know that both Pete and I were out this week. And Pete was in Texas. I was in New York. I went to New York for a memorial. It was beautiful. It was a great, great experience to me, be among friends and to say goodbye to a friend who died way too young at the age of 54. And she died of breast cancer, and it was a great experience. And what a great performance by her daughters, her high school daughters, play the cello and the violin. And they got up in front of a packed room in Staten Island, performed beautifully. It was such a great testament. It was just a great moment for Leah, who the mom, who was such an artistic person, to watch her daughters tribute her in that way. It was great to be in the room. And, of course, it was great to be in New York City. And I got a chance to do some fun stuff, like go to Electric Lady Studios. We talked about that in this program. I walked over there on Saturday. And also the awning. I didn't know this, but the awning where is on the cover of Paul's Boutique, which is the Beastie Boys album, famous album. It's right there on the Lower East Side. I had no idea we were standing right in front of it. There's a big Beastie Boys mural on the Lower East Side, and I was like, oh, I don't know why I always thought that was Brooklyn, but there it was. So I got to see that too. It's a real musical journey for me yesterday and Saturday. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. We'll take our first break here. We got a big show, so we're going to get to it here. 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200. John Greenfeld from Streets Blog Chicago is going to join us, come up here in about 10 minutes. And after that, Kevin Green will be here to talk about behavioral sciences when it comes to the environment. And in the 9 o'clock hour, it is a Fat Tuesday version of the Chicago Accent Challenge. 312-981-7200. As I was saying, I was in New York City, and I got a chance to go over to see Electric Lady Studios. I was very excited about it. If you're not familiar, this is the Jimi Hendrix studio that he built in the Village, in Greenwich Village, just north of there by Washington Square Park. And the story goes that he built it as Electric Lady Studios, and it was going to be his hangout spot. He's going to do everything. I think it was 6 months after he built it is when he died. And so this unbelievable space that was built as a clubhouse for all the classic rockers of the 60s did not have much to do with Jimi Hendrix after all. But a lot of great musicians from Led Zeppelin to the Beatles to others have graced the stage there. And then in the 70s and 80s, or graced the studios. I think the 80s, it went sour. I think it closed up shop for a little bit. Everything was locked up. Neighborhood change, things like that. And then in the 90s, our very own Chicago, Common, and Questlove from The Roots, D'Angelo, an R&B star, they opened up. They wanted to connect to the Roots that was the Electric Lady Studio. So they I don't know if they purchased it, what they did, but they opened it back up. They dusted off the cobwebs, and they used that studio to record all sorts of great 2000s R&B records, all the stuff that your kids would know, right? Everything from Erykah Badu to Common and, you know, The Roots, all the way down the line. So that's what I was really into, because I had gone deep on that when we had Common on the program. I was trying to get, you know, as I started to get into his history, I found this part of his history, and there's some great documentaries and things online about it. And now, today, it is thriving. That's where Lady Gaga does their recording, Kanye West, all the hot, the Strokes, all the hot bands of New York City, right? So I figured out where it was, did the old Google map, you know, walked over there. And like everything in my life, and I know this is a weakness of mine, I, for some reason, always think I'm the only person that cares, right? Like I had found a gem, a hidden gem in Electric Lady Studios. There's no way anybody else is camping out on that space. I'm going to walk up there. I'm going to walk into the reception. I'm going to say, hey, I'm a big fan. Is there any way I could take a picture with Stevie Wonder's piano? And they're going to let me, right? And I had a $20 bill with me. And I was thinking about doing the old Chicago politics, you know, give them a little handshake. Like, what's it going to take to get a selfie with that piano? It didn't come to that. But when I got to the space, there was a little pilgrimage outside. There were probably 10 to 15 people that were already there, just kind of milling about. At first, I was like, well, it's like a new yogurt spot? Maybe a new coffee, you know, one of these craft artisan coffee places that everybody's out here? No, it was for the space. And so, I took a picture in front of it, which is very weird when people are staring at you taking a picture. And hilariously, one of the guys goes, it didn't look like this back in the day, man. And it's a cool front. It's like it's a contemporary kind of thing to it. It's not how it looked like, man. I was like, hey, I don't know your truth. Give me mine, man. I'm not here about Jimi Hendrix. I'm here for the Soulquarians. I want to see where Badu did her original album, you know? But he's trying to tell me, you know, what it was like when Zeppelin and Cream were there. That's someone else's truth. So I open the door, and then they have another door. And in there, they have like a little circle, like a glass circle, that's where the receptionist sits. He or she was not there. I rang the doorbell a couple times, and nobody came forward. So I lose, right? I come out of the Electric Lady Studios, and everybody's in awe that I just had opened the door. So all those people I just mentioned, they're middling about, and everybody there, nobody had the stones to actually open the door and see what was on the other side. And so the minute I did that and I was coming out, they all like put their foot in the door like, oh, we want to get a picture of the second door. And I had created this melee in front of Electric Lady Studios just because I was the only one who actually had the courage to open the door. And I thought in my head, I'm like, this is rock and roll, right? It's supposed to be a little bit. We're supposed to be, you know, not follow the rules. It's okay to open a door. If it's locked, it's locked. I was just really surprised by it. But I had a good time in New York City. I tried to convince the fam. As we were sitting down for our second of three $100 breakfasts. That's the one thing about New York, which is crazy. You just go to a breakfast plate for eggs and pancakes or whatever it might be. And everything is a real fancy $18. We went to a coffee shop this morning, or a breakfast place, and the coffee at the breakfast place was $5.75, Pete, just for the coffee. Usually they get you there with a $3, maybe a $3.50. $5.75 was a lot of expensive breakfasts. But it was a good time. We stayed in Soho, which is a really nice neighborhood, of course, in New York. It used to be something different, an artist colony, and you see kind of remnants of it. Now it's kind of the fashion mecca. Stella McCartney, Gucci. Didn't hear of any smash and grabs in New York, but that they get them here on Michigan Avenue. But I laugh because we stayed in a New York hotel that my wife found a good value on, which is ridiculous because there's no good values for New York hotels. And you walk in, and it was so chic and stylish that there was no desk that you checked into. So there was no, you know, hi, can I help you? Like concierge or anything like that. There were just freestanding dudes who walked around like it was the Portillo's drive-thru and checked you in on an iPad. Oh, you're here for the show? Oh, yeah. Boop, 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 boop. Oh, yeah. You know, we've got $10 credit on the minibar. Boop, 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 boop. Here you are. And they said, you know, they gave us, we checked in, we're on the 15th floor. We're like, all right. And they go, they're going to just go in the elevator and hit PH. And I was like, what? And I'm like, penthouse? Right. I was like, I kind of got nervous because I said to my wife, I was like, did you book the wrong? Like, I'm not paying for a penthouse. Like, this is crazy. It's New York City already. Why are we on the? And also, why didn't you just tell? Like, I was in my head. I was like, why didn't you just say you're in the penthouse? Why would you say hit PH? And I found out we got upstairs. It's just a normal. It's a normal floor. Probably used to be something different. They got rid of the penthouses because as we made the turn in the really cool hallway with the cool kind of lit, dim lit black light. Oh, so cool. And we opened the door. We're like, oh, yeah, New York hotel room. One bed and a window. I bumped into my family so much this trip. It was like, I got bruises on the side of my knees and elbows. And everything. Excuse me. Can I get over there? You couldn't go to the bathroom without having a PhD in geometry to figure out all the different doors because they all had to shut one way or the other because it was such a small space. It was almost like I felt like it was a Monty Python sketch trying to maneuver as small as it was. But it was a good time. I had a great time and good to be back home. Feel like I didn't see a lot of masks. We were talking for the last couple of weeks about the airports and whether or not we're going to see a ton of masks. People, I was ready and raring for the person who coughed too much on the plane. None of that stuff. I had none of that experience, which I guess is good. I had no recline or not recline controversy. I'm not much of a recliner. No one reclined into me. So maybe that has worked. Now that we have figured that out, perhaps we can work on when the plane stops and gets to the gate and they hit the tone, bing, for everyone to stand up, that we don't have people who bum rush the door. Can we do a viral video on that? Because that is the most insane anti-human. I should ask our behavioral scientist about that tonight. How does that work? Why does that keep happening? If everybody just sat in their spots and waited to get their luggage, you would have a better flow out the plane than people who bum rush the door. Are you a bum rusher? 312-981-7200. I think this is the time to explain yourself. I don't know why it is. Always on the way to New York, too. Maybe because there's a speed to that city. So maybe people are already antsy. It always seems like that's... I mean, it happens everywhere. But it feels like you're going into New York. They hit that thing. People, that seatbelt is off. And they are running to that door. They want to be first in line. Even though everybody has to deplane at the same... It's madness. It's complete madness. So tell me about it. Are you a bum rusher? Are you the person who is like, hey, first come, first serve. I got to get mine. I want to get to that baggage area and wait longer than you. It's not like your bags are going to be there first. 312-981-7200. 815 says Electric Lady Studios is three blocks from the Stonewall. Yeah, the bar that started the riot, that started what many say is the gay movement in America. Yeah, Greenwich Village, that whole area. Yeah, it was cool. I felt like such a dope in thinking I would be the only one that would have any interest in Electric Lady Studios. Because it had gone through 20 years of disrepair or nobody cared. And now it's back and it's something different. So I can understand like a gaggle of teenagers who want to see, you know, One Direction coming out of there or something like that. But I was surprised at the pilgrimage of the 60s rockers, almost like a Jim Morrison grave situation. And yay, man, hey, it didn't look like that back in the day, man. When I would see Steppenwolf, didn't look like that. All right. Thank you. All right. And John Greenfield's coming up here. We'll talk about CTA and whether or not they should add conductors and what we should do overall about the mass transit situation here in Chicago. It's Justin Kaufman. It's 720 WGN. Stay with us. 630 says, I always remember in elementary school when we had to practice evacuating a school bus in case of a fire. They showed a video of what would happen when people stayed seated. And alternate turns, obviously, very chaotically rushing the front of the bus. It made sense to me as an 8-year-old, and I've applied that rule on airplanes ever since. Yeah, you are a sane individual. You seem to be someone who wants to contribute to society, not someone who wants to burn it all down. 312 says, NYC is only expensive if you want it to be. There are endless bagel places. Bagel and coffee, $6 to $7. You're absolutely right. You are absolutely right. You're not traveling with my wife, who doesn't. It's like, oh, what about this place? Oh, man. There's old breakfast place in Soho. And I'm willing to throw down $35, $40 on a breakfast. I'm sure you are too, especially special occasion kind of thing. But in New York, it's 70 or 80. It's ridiculous. I got lucky over the time because dinners weren't, because of the memorial and other things, they weren't part of the equation. So I was okay because I just kind of tricked myself to say breakfast is dinner. I feel like I was, but it was just amazing. But I totally agree with you. That's what I said. I said, I want to move to New York. I could do it. I could slum it. I could get an apartment where my bed is in a closet. And I could eat at this bagel place every single day of my life. But the family gave me two thumbs downs. I lost 2-3 on that one. So it looks like we're staying in Chicago. One of the things I noticed in New York were the abundance of bus lanes. And a serious commitment to congestion, traffic, and bus traffic. It was pretty intense. If you go down on Canal Street or other places where you usually get a intense amount of traffic, New York City seemed to be making a move towards a new type of traffic pattern. Will we see that in Chicago? John Greenfield writes for Streets Blog Chicago. He's great. He joins us now. John, good to talk to you.
Good to be here, Justin.
There seems to be today a push. There was a story today. You wrote about it as well, about the idea that the CTA is experimenting with more ways to get people on the bus, to put a fare card reader on the back door, and to really change the way we know public transportation in Chicago. This is something that's being done in other cities. We're finally starting to catch up.
Right. So the announcement that happened today is that the CTA is going to pilot all-door boarding, which means you can enter from both the front and the back of the bus. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of similar to what's been done in New York with the select bus lines, which were the ones you were talking about, these express bus lines they have. They have something like, I think the number is 52 miles of bus lanes compared to Chicago's about 5 miles of bus lanes. So when you ride a select bus, one of the reasons they're so fast is because when the bus arrives, you've already bought your fare. You've already paid a ticket by, they have these little machines, kiosks at each bus stop, buy a little paper ticket. And then when the bus shows up, they have special buses that have three doors. You can enter through any of the three doors. There's no standing in line to like swipe your venture card. Mm. So it's really fast boarding. It cuts down what we call dwell time at stations.
Yeah, that's the worst.
And so, I mean, the thing is, New York has been doing this for many years. And Chicago, we got the Loop Link downtown. So we got a couple miles of dedicated bus lanes. There's a few other bells and whistles, but they never came through with the prepaid boarding that they promised. They tested it there back in 2016, but decided that it wasn't worth doing on the entire system. The way they did it back then was having a CTA employee hanging out at the Dearborn and Madison stop with a mobile card reader.
Right.
And then you would swipe your venture card before you got on the bus.
It was like the people who were in my the concierge in my hotel. They were doing this. That was how they were doing checking us in New York. But I was amazed because you would think in New York, because it's such close quarters and traffic's at a premium, but it does seem like there's a commitment, and it hasn't necessarily changed traffic patterns for the worse. You would think automatically, and that's been a little bit of the criticism, saying, well, if we give up all this real estate to bus lanes on some of the north-south streets that are coming out of the loop, it's going to cause traffic jams. But that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, I mean, the basic gospel that I'm preaching as a sustainable transportation advocate is that cars, you know, large metal boxes that contain a person or two, are just not an efficient way to move people through cities. And so when we talk about doing things like converting travel lanes that you can drive in to bus or bike lanes, you know, a lot of people will panic and say like, oh, that's going to create a traffic jam because there won't be enough room for cars. But, you know, if buses are so much more space efficient than cars, in the space of the amount of street space that maybe three or four cars take up, you can have an articulated CTA bus that holds 60 people. So anyway, the loop link, you know, it was a good idea to have to convert some of the lanes on streets like Madison and Washington mm-hmm. to bus lanes, and they also put in a nice protected bike lane on Washington. But the problem is they did kind of a half-hearted job with it because they didn't do the prepaid boarding, and also they don't enforce the bus lanes right. very well. In New York, they use camera enforcement, so if you are driving or parking in the bus lane, you're going to get ticketed for it. And, you know, things like red light cameras are a little more controversial, but the fact is everybody knows they're not supposed to be driving or parking in bus lanes. They say CTA bus only, or, you know, in New York, they say select bus only. So there's not really any excuse. But what happened, we had a couple pieces of good news last week because Lori Lightfoot introduced an ordinance that would allow parking aides to take a photograph of drivers parked in bike lanes, take a photograph of the license plate. And that way, even if the driver tries to get out of the ticket by driving out of the bus or bike lane, they can mail the ticket to the driver, you know, get the identity of the car owner from the Secretary of State's office and ticket them that way. So that's going to help hold people accountable for blocking
bus
lanes.
And that's something as well. That's something as well that's done in other big cities. That's something that surprisingly we scratch our head in Chicago that why it's not done. But it almost reminds me, and I want to ask you as well, about the box. Because this happens in New York and L.A. where there'll be the box that you can't block an intersection, and they have the box on the ground. We had a study that came out saying that why hasn't Chicago adopted this a couple weeks ago? But the same thing, if you're in that box and there is somebody around that is a parking enforcement person in New York, they just take a picture and you're, boom, ticket.
Yeah, that would be a great thing to bring here. But, you know, along with the photo enforcement of bus and bike lanes, so today what they announced is they're going to do a pilot on the Jeffrey Jump bus, the J14, which comes from the south side, goes up Lakeshore Drive, and goes downtown. And the 192 bus, which is the University of Chicago Hospitals Express, which has a sort of a parallel route. They are installing Venture card readers on the rear door of all the buses on those lines. Mm-hmm. So it's 30 buses total. They're all articulated accordion-style double-long buses. And so, you know, it's a pilot to see how that works out, the way it's going to work. Now, it's important to remember it's not prepaid boarding, because in prepaid boarding, like the Select, you're paying before the bus shows up.
Right.
With this, you're going to pay when the bus shows up, but you'll be able to enter through either the front or the rear door. If you're paying with cash, you got to enter through the front door. But if you're paying with a Venture card, you can enter through the rear door, swipe your Venture card on the card reader, which will probably be like on the side of the door, and the driver will have a special monitor or light on their console, which will let them know when a fare has been paid. There's also a convex mirror that lets them keep tabs on the rear door. So in theory, they'll be able to see when, you know, notice when somebody doesn't pay and boards through the rear door. In practice, I'm sure some people will fall through the cracks. So what one of our readers suggested they do during the pilot, which is going to last from June to the end of the year, is have plainclothes CTA employees sitting near the back door. And, you know, it wouldn't be a good idea to have them confront people who walk in without paying, but just keep track of it and, you know, see just
right as a study.
Are they losing major amounts of revenue
right.
because people are sneaking in the back door?
I was
door.
Just thinking of all the citizens' arrests that would be happening when they get up and or maybe give them a taser. The CTA employees could just have a taser.
Let me just say now, if anyone's listening here and, like, this kicks in and you see people boarding the rear bus without paying, like, don't be a hero.
Yeah,
don't try to, like, intervene.
Right.
Like, I don't want you to get hurt.
Right.
You know, it's a little annoying that other cities like New York have had fast buses for many years. I know the Select bus officially launched in 2008. I don't know, like, when they implemented prepaid boarding, but, you know, they kind of take fast buses for granted there. They did something really cool recently, which is in Manhattan on 14th Street in Lower Manhattan near the Financial District. They basically made a street bus transit priority. People are allowed to drive on it, but you can basically only drive for one block at a time just to do pickups and drop-offs.
Mm.
Truck drivers are allowed to use the street in a normal way, but I think that goes for both private vehicles and Uber and Lyft drivers, is you can only go on the street for a block at a time. And that has really had a great effect on bus speeds. I think it has increased the speeds of buses up to 50% at some times a day.
Wow.
So ridership is really increasing. So I'd love to see the CTA do something like that on some important bus route like Halsted or Ashland, where they were seriously considering doing full-fledged bus rapid transit, which is where you like get buses up to subway speeds through various techniques. So that was all good stuff.
John Greenfield, let me just re-enter you. John Greenfield is with Streets Blog Chicago. It's a great site. Check it out. We're talking about transportation issues. One of the things about Chicago is, do you believe from your perch, from doing the blog and also writing for The Reader and other places, that Chicago is making the future of transportation a priority? Because you just heard, and I can't even believe I'm hearing that Manhattan and New York City would say, let's do a whole transportation priority first, mass transit priority first street. That just seems so antithetical to what we know as, how we live in America. Do you consider Chicago to be a forward-thinking, progressive transportation city?
Well, we're kind of like a compromise between a place like L.A. where you pretty much have to have a car to get along around efficiently, and a place like New York where having a car is a real pain in the neck. Most people in New York commute by transit. A pretty small minority of people in L.A. commute by transit. Chicago is kind of a compromise. I live car-free. My life is pretty convenient. I live in a pretty transit-friendly neighborhood uptown. But, if you want to own a car here, it's still not that much of a hassle to own one, depending on where you live. Yeah. Definitely that's the direction cities are moving, is less car dependency. Even L.A., they passed a half-cent sales tax several years ago, which is funding all these new transit lines. And Chicago's not really building new transit lines. So with the exception of they're supposed to be extending the red line south from 95th to Altgeld Gardens around 130th. But, L.A., they built like the subway to the sea going to Santa Barbara and all these new lines. So it would really be kind of embarrassing if L.A. caught up with Chicago in terms of being a transit-friendly city. So, how is Chicago doing? I think Lori Lightfoot is generally on the right page. Her during the mayoral election, the transportation platform she put out was really good. And she's starting to fulfill some of those promises. The Alder boarding thing was part of that. The bus lane enforcement was part of that. She's starting to build more bus lanes. I think she's kind of like starting to come through with these promises. The main thing that I want to see her change her position on is there's a proposal to create more frequent and more affordable Southside Metro service on the Metro Electric District line and the Rock Island District line. So those are the two major Southside lines. And the idea is to lower the fares to something close to CTA fare and make them come more frequently so that they're more convenient for commuting. And that would create better transit access for people on the south side, especially low-income folks. What really is a shame is that there are people who live near metro lines who could have a really quick commute downtown, but because metro is a few dollars more expensive than the CTA, people will, say instead of taking a direct train route downtown from, say, South Shore, they'll just take a bus west on, say, 79th Street to the Red Line, and then take that downtown. But it's a much longer, less convenient trip. If we made Metric financially competitive with the CTA, that would really open up a lot of doors for people in terms of being able to access more jobs, educational opportunities. But the problem is that the main cheerleader for that pilot, which is called the South Cook Fair Transit Pilot, is Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle,
right.
Who is like, Lori Lightfoot
adversary.
And her still have bad blood. So that combined with the fact that Mayor Lightfoot controls the CTA, she doesn't have much control over Metro. Lightfoot gets to appoint most of the board members on the CTA, and I think she only gets to appoint one or two Metro board members. So therefore, you know, you got this stupid competition between CTA and Metra where Lightfoot doesn't want to lose ridership. She doesn't want people to, you know, take the Metra Electric instead of taking the 79th Street bus to the Red Line. But it's just totally counterproductive if our goal is to give Southsiders better transit access.
Right,
it doesn't really matter whether they're taking CTA or Metra. And what makes it really dumb is that Cook County is allocating funds to compensate Metra and the CTA for any lost revenue. So it's like a no-brainer for Chicago. So, you know, it really raises the accusation that Lightfoot is doing this just partly
political.
Out of a personal grudge against Preckwinkle, which is just makes no sense.
Yeah. John Greenfield, the editor over at Chicago at Street Blog Chicago. We'll take a quick break, and we got to talk about crime on the CTA. We'll wrap up and talk about should conductors come back to the trains. 312-981-7200. John Greenfield with me. Stay with us. John Greenfield's with me. He is the editor over at Streets Blog Chicago, a great site about transportation in our area. And we're talking about the CTA changes. We're also talking about one of the issues that has just been in the headlines over and over and over. We've talked about in this program has been crime on the CTA. It just seems to be so prevalent this winter. Even if the CTA will come out and say that, oh well, the crime's down, but when you really parse this, the numbers, you see that it's up. Regardless, one of the things we talked about, John, was just the idea that the trains back in the 90s, they made a big choice to take conductors off the train. Should we bring them back?
Yeah, that was an idea that I proposed as an alternate to more policing on the CTA. At Streets Blog, we try not to sensationalize crime on transit. Our point of view is that crime can happen anywhere in the city, right, anywhere in public space. But, no doubt there's definitely been some disturbing stuff going on the CTA lately. I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean statistically that the CTA is more dangerous than other forms of transportation, especially because you're not going to get in a car crash on the CTA. But I think it was a Tribune investigation that found in recent years, crime on platforms, serious crime has doubled. And just, you know, there were a bunch of scary incidents lately. There have just been all these violent robberies. I mean, some of it's not really major stuff, like someone getting punched and having their cell phone grabbed. But, we've seen some scary incidents, like there was a street musician, Machete Mike, who was stabbed by a woman on the Jackson platform because she didn't like his music. There was a guy shot on the Blue Line near UIC Halsted. Recently, there was a shooting in the Jackson Tunnel between the Blue Line and Red Line stations. So we're seeing calls for more policing. I mean, the city actually announced, we got this new interim police chief, Charlie Beck, who came from L.A. He said that they're going to have SWAT team officers patrolling CTA trains. Mm-hmm. It's understandable that people would want more police officers. Jackson definitely seems to be a problem spot. So lately there have been police officers stationed at Jackson. I think that makes some sense. But, when we reported on this, some of our readers brought up, like, yeah, adding more Chicago police, that's going to make everyone feel safer, sarcastically, because obviously the Chicago Police Department has well-documented issues with misconduct and abuse. We had things like the Laquan McDonald case, obviously. Saturating the system with cops is probably not the answer. I'm not saying that we don't need more policing right now, but we don't want, you know, police to be everywhere on the CTA. Because you said you were in New York recently, and that's basically how things have been in New York recently, with Governor Cuomo decided he wanted to crack down on fare evasion. So you'll just see photos of like lines of police by the turnstiles. So that's led to a lot of arrests of people for fare evasion. You know, usually people who can't afford to pay the fare, which means low-income people. More often than not, they're people of color. And we're just seeing crackdowns for, like, stupid quality of life stuff in New York, like little old ladies selling churros, Mexican donuts, getting handcuffed. And that's really not what we want the police to be doing on transit.
And I don't think they want to be doing that either, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're probably not thrilled about the situation either. But there was a huge protest in New York a few weeks ago where, like, hundreds of people stormed lots of stations, including Grand Central Station, jumping turnstiles, as a form of civil disobedience. They did some stuff I don't condone, like using Gorilla Glue to gum up the fare card readers and, you know, spray painting F the cops on the walls of the train stations. I don't think that trashing public property that everybody uses is a great way to make a protest. But anyway, they did have a point, which is like the kind of policing they're doing in New York is not making people feel safer. I hopefully that the Chicago police will be more disciplined about that, and they will really focus on, you know, actual problems that are making people unsafe on CTA, rather than just like looking for stuff to enforce.
Right.
So with that in mind, you know, I was thinking, I'm definitely a fan of using civilian interventions as, you know, a strategy for addressing crime and other issues that, you know, I'd like to see more like soft approaches to dealing with crime than, you know, having our first resort be tough guys with guns. So, you know, I think when there were people walking around on CTA trains or hanging out on CTA trains, authority figures, that made people feel a little safer. I think that behavior was probably better. You know, there are, in addition to deterring crime, there are quality of life issues on the CTA that I think conductors can help out with. One thing that really annoys me, and I know it bothers a lot of people, especially people with respiratory issues, is there seems to be an uptick in smoking on the CTA. And that's definitely not going to get any better with the legalization of marijuana, recreational marijuana in Illinois. I'm not anti-pot, but just like it's probably a fact of life. We're going to have more people smoking pot on trains. You know, littering, that's a drag. So having people who would deter that behavior would be great. You know, another really tough nut to crack is there's a big issue with homeless people sheltering on trains. And when I say that's an issue, what it is a symptom of our city's failure to address our affordable housing crisis. So, you know, if you're going to complain about all the homeless people sleeping on the CTA, you know, sleeping across lots of seats, bringing big parcels on the trains, things like that, then you really should be complaining about the fact that Chicago's not doing enough to give people places to live. Right. And we got problems like single resident occupancy hotels being converted into luxury micro apartments, stuff like that, that eliminates affordable housing, deconversions where apartment buildings are turned into McMansions, you know, that only have a single home instead of six households.
And the CTA the CTA is going to be a spot that you're going to find a lot of sheltering, and you're also going to find so many different ills in society that kind of, you know, obviously becomes the face of it. John, we're going to have to leave it there because I'm out of time. John Greenfield is the editor over at Streets Blog Chicago. We love when he comes on the program talking a little bit about whether or not we should just put conductors on the trains again instead of police enforcement, which seems to be the route the mayor and the CPD are going. As we saw, SWAT teams are going to be in place on CTA to help deter some of the crime. John, always great to talk to you. Thanks for calling, man.
All right. Thanks for having me.
312-981-7200. Justin Kaufman with you here on 720 WGN. Last hour, we talked a little bit about whether or not Chicago is a transit city by nature, and if it's moving in that direction to be a transit-forward city. And coming up in the next hour, Ted McClellan's going to be here, our resident linguist. We're going to do the Chicago Accent Challenge just in time for Fat Tuesday. What do you call the jelly donut, the Polish jelly donut that is big on Fat Tuesday? I'm not going to say it because I want you to pronounce it when you call in the 9 o'clock hour. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Well, tomorrow night at the Spertus Institute right there on South Michigan Avenue, they're going to host a panel discussion with some of the leading experts on climate change as part of their Critical Conversation series. This is the third year they've produced the series. It'll feature a slew of big names, including David Wallace Wells, who's the deputy editor over at New York Magazine, Bill McKibben, a legendary environmentalist, and my guest tonight, Kevin Green. Kevin Green is the vice president at RARE and also the head of the Center for Behavior and the Environment. Kevin specializes in behavioral sciences and how human behavior stands in the way of serious climate change. Changing our habits, changing our routines, taking on something that is shared sacrifice may be harder than it seems. I mean, I know. Taking a long hot shower is bad for the environment. I know that. And I know my lackadaisical approach to recycling is counterproductive, but I do it anyway. Why? Kevin Green in studio with me tonight. Kevin, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's get into this because we're smart, we're rational, and at the end of the day, we're led by our emotions.
That's right. Yeah. You know, environmentalists have been really, really good at giving people facts, mostly the bad news is what it tends to be. And the unfortunate truth is that facts just don't really change minds. You know, we're not particularly good at updating our beliefs when we get new information that's inconsistent with those beliefs. And so, you know, people are funny. If you think of having a debate with your buddy about some fact and you can't seem to agree. And so what do you do to settle the score? You Google it. And so, you know, imagine you Google it and the first 9 results that you get on the Google search say pretty much exactly what your buddy was saying. But the 10th agrees with you. So what do you do?
Right.
You ignore the first 9 and then you click on the 10th.
Right.
And that's just true of human behavior generally. We look for information that confirms what we already believe. And so, you know, facts are tricky things, and there's a lot of other things that motivate what we do. So that's what we work on.
When you talk about human behavior and behavioral sciences, what is that? What is behavioral sciences?
So behavioral science is exactly what it sounds like. It's the science of what motivates people to make the decisions that they do, what makes people tick, why we choose to do the things that we do and why we don't do some things. And it can be from a range of disciplines, from social psychology to neuroscience to even behavioral economics, which is sort of the integration of psychology into economics. All of this is geared toward understanding why people do the strange things that they do.
Now, obviously, you can make a strong correlation to how it pertains to climate change, or how it be even beyond that, because I think climate change is a word or a phrase that automatically gets people into their silos, into their emotions. Don't you think so? It's surprising to me, because they're really just talking about the environment. But that phrase is one that is has to be in your wheelhouse when it comes to behavioral sciences.
Yeah, no, it's totally true. I mean, words can often be shortcuts for people in terms of associating with all sorts of other attitudes and beliefs that we have. And climate change has so much baggage now that it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and so brings with it a lot of other emotional responses, some of which are not particularly positive. If you have a certain political orientation, you might have certain associations with the term climate change or global warming. Another feature of it is maybe climate change now provokes feelings of fear or even panic. You know, we have this problem now with kids suffering from eco-anxiety as a result of climate change. So it may bring lots of other sorts of emotional responses that may also lead to inaction. And so that's something that we think a lot about as well.
Kevin Green's here, 312-981-7200. Kevin's the vice president at RARE. You can find all that information at rare.org. He's also the head of the Center for Behavior and the Environment. And we're talking about behavioral sciences when it comes to the environment. And I would think that I kind of started by just teasing out the idea that for a long time, the movement of environmentalists and scientists who wanted to warn people about how the planet is changing because of human behavior, it was all about awareness. It was all about, you know, nonstop. Let me show you this, the Al Gore movies. Everything was about awareness, awareness, awareness. At what point do you have to say that we're done with awareness, that it's time to think about behavioral changes?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we often say that knowledge or awareness is often a necessary but very rarely a sufficient condition for change. So it's not to say that awareness doesn't matter. Sometimes it really doesn't. But, you know, when you boil down the science of human behavior, the key takeaway is that people are really complicated. And although we may want to be the sort of rational decision makers that we imagine the human species to be, we're not always as good at it as we like to think. And so I think we can all understand that oftentimes our emotional responses work more quickly and more strongly than our rational thinking brains. And so you know, emotional triggers can have a lot of control over behavior, and there may be a lot of good evolutionary reasons for that. We're also deeply social animals. We care about what other people think about us. We actually like to cooperate. We like to reciprocate. And so social influence, the behavior of our peers, can have a big influence on us. And we also have a lot of decision-making shortcuts kind of subconscious happening in the background that maybe we're not even really aware of, but that have a profound impact on the decisions that we make just based on the context that we're in, the environment that we're in, we're making decisions.
Kevin Green, my guest, he's going to be part of the Critical Conversation series on climate change tomorrow at Spertus Institute. There are limited tickets available, so head over to the Spertus Institute website and you can find them. And, of course, come out to see Kevin, including many others who will be on this panel as well. I mentioned a few, but there's some great names that are going to be in Chicago as part of this critical conversation that is happening at Spertus Institute tomorrow night. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back more with Kevin Green here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Justin Kaufman with you here on 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. We're talking about behavioral sciences, climate change tonight. Kevin Green is the vice president at RARE. He's also the head of the Center for Behavior and the Environment, which is also a center at RARE. He's going to be part of the Critical Conversation series, which is at Spertus Institute. They do it every year. They take on one topic. It's different every year, and they bring in some really great voices from around the world. This is on climate change. So David Wallace Wells will be there, Bill McKibben, and many more. Check it out. Limited tickets available. It's tomorrow night at Spertus on Michigan Avenue. Kevin, one of the things about this we're talking about, and you hear this over and over and over, is that people are resigned to the fact that this challenge is too big. That if I, you know, is really going to make a difference if I add an extra couple minutes to my hot shower. Like the idea that I am not, I can't make a difference with the little life that I live.
Justin, I'm here to tell you that you can make a difference.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You know,
but you hear that a lot, right? I mean, that seems to be the big thing when it comes to how overwhelming climate change is.
Well, there are a lot of things that you know, alone don't make a difference. But, you know, I think there's another way to look at it. You know, the other thing to say about people is that, you know, we're maybe the best problem-solving species to ever walk the earth, but just not a problem like climate change. And so this is where it gets interesting, because we like problems that are really proximate and personal. Think of the sort of threats that our early ancestors faced on the savannah. Those are the types of problems that we like to solve. And climate change can feel like neither of those things. It's kind of distant. It's hard to connect cause to effect. Mm-hmm. And as you said, it feels like it doesn't really matter to me. And it definitely feels like I don't matter to it. And you know, all of this is obviously changing, but it's been a slow process, and now you have people really waking up to this crisis and recognizing that, you know, it really is a crisis. And so you have people having feelings of panic and fear. These are very real, and also potentially associated with that, feelings of despair or mm-hmm. defeatism. I can't possibly make a difference.
Or dismissive. And that's got to be in the family, right? This idea that, all right, you know, whatever I do, it's not going to help.
That's right. Well, the first stage is kind of the cognitive dissonance stage, where you say, I have these mutually inconsistent beliefs. On the one hand, I like to do these things that require burning fossil fuels. On the other hand, I'm learning that burning fossil fuels is causing climate change. And so the first stage of that is sort of like denial or dismissiveness. Like, one of those can't be true. Mm-hmm. When you start to realize that it is true, you see weather events that are being caused by climate change. You see these, you know, these effects in the real world. Now you start to appreciate that it's real, and then potentially shift to this sort of defeatism that you're talking about. You know, there's nothing that I can do that can make a difference. What I'll tell you is that we have looked at the data. And the bottom line is that actions that you take at the individual and household level, if they're started by even 5 to 10% of Americans, can have a really tremendous impact on reducing greenhouse gases.
I guess you kind of see that a little bit with our recycling movement. At a certain point in the 80s, you'd say maybe in the early 90s, recycling was a do-gooder's pursuit. Someone who was really right. Believed in it and the rest was like, eh. And now you see, as every household kind of gets into the concept that, all right, if I do this, if I recycle this stuff, I guess I'm doing my part. And you're seeing more and more recycling happen.
That's right. That's right. Well, you're making a very good point there. You know, there are many small behaviors that don't add up to much. You know, I'm not here to tell you that changing your light bulbs is going to save the world. Change your light bulbs. It's a good idea. Please change your light bulbs to LEDs. But it's not going to save the world. But there are things, you know, like cutting your food waste by about a fifth and composting the rest, or maybe just getting a few more of your calories from plant-based foods and relying a little bit less on meat, getting your home energy from renewable sources by going through your utility or even installing solar, even opting for an electric vehicle when you go out to buy a new car, or just ditching the car altogether if you're fortunate enough to live in a place where you can
ditch your car, right? right.
Add these things up at a big scale, and they aren't enough to solve the problem alone, right? We do need policy, major policy action, major changes on a systemic level. But to say that it's a choice between one or the other is a false dichotomy. These behaviors do really have a big impact on their own. But the key is what you said. When you start to do these things, two things happen. One, you start to see yourself more as a part of the solution, and you begin to evaluate other decisions that you're making through the same lens. So you get a sort of snowball effect in your decision making that leads to other green behaviors. I start to see myself as someone who does these sort of things.
You're proud of it.
You're proud. Exactly. Yeah, right, you're proud of it. And so it has a snowball effect for your own behavior. Two, even more so, and this is the really powerful one, you start to influence those around you. As I said, humans are incredibly social species, and we tend to model our behavior after our peers. We call this social influence. So, for instance, we know that one of the strongest predictors of whether or not you as an individual have solar panels on your house is not more so than your income or your age or your education or your race or lots of these other factors that we might expect. A much stronger predictor is whether or not your neighbors also have solar panels.
I totally get it. And, you know, I know there's, to take it outside of climate change for a second, you think about the way people entertain themselves, whether you're cutting a cord on a cable company or perhaps using the latest technology or perhaps even when you talk about what kind of vehicle. There is a lot that's run by your peers. If your neighbors are doing it, your friends are doing it, that's usually that word of mouth is going to move you in that direction.
That's right. We like to move with the herd. You know, we're a highly social species. The economist Bob Frank and others call this a behavioral contagion effect. It's kind of a good sort of contagion. Change begets change, and it can be incredibly powerful.
Well, let's stay right there for a second. And we're talking with Kevin Green, behavioral scientist, but also the vice president at RARE, which is also the Center for Behavior and the Environment. He's part of the Critical Conversation series at Spertus tomorrow night. We're taking on climate change. But just staying with that kind of idea of us being part of the herd, this group, whatever you say, contagion, right? What would it take for us to all assume, like if it was one of those things, if we just determined as a society that's got to be solar, or we just determine, and we talked about this on this program before, you know what, let's stop making meat. let's go to a plant-based diet. How do you make that happen? How do you get, is it a leader? Do you say like a president who says this is the policy and we're all going to stick to it, which doesn't necessarily work because we see that it has happened in the past? Is it a celebrity? Is it a how do we do that? It seems like that's the part where I get lost as a human being who's like, you can't change your behavior that way.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's like the mother of all coordination or cooperation problems. You know, you were talking earlier on the program about bum rushers on the airplane.
Yeah, right.
Why can't we cooperate on airplanes? Well, actually, we do cooperate in a lot of really important ways on airplanes. There's a lot of things that people don't do on airplanes that really they could that would drive everybody nuts. but one thing that people do is sort of everybody just hurries to get off of the airplane, because that's like a classic cooperation problem. It's the sort of thing where what's good for the whole group isn't necessarily what's good for the individual. So any individual has an incentive to sort of defect from the group and try to be the first one off the airplane.
Because that, in their mind, that means they're going to be first. That means they're going to be fast. They're going to get to where they need to get before everybody
else. They're going to get to waiting at baggage claim before everybody else.
Right.
But that's right. And to solve that sort of thing, the reason it's a good analogy is to solve that sort of thing, you require some things to be true. You require a certain almost social contract amongst the group, that we all implicitly or even explicitly agree that we're going to sit in our seats and wait our turn. And
that's a social contract. That's one that we're just like, we know as human beings, you do this, you don't do that.
I mean, airlines have all sorts of other rules, so they could.
That's not a social contract. That's a policy. Right.
But we could all agree, just as we agree not to you know, just walk around streets pushing each other on the sidewalks. You know, maybe that would be a crime, but you know, we all agree not to do that to each other. We agree not to do certain things on airplanes. Some people break those norms. We call those norms, and some people violate those, and then they get called out on Twitter or something. You see pictures of people cutting their toenails or something on airplanes.
Or clearly a violation. Reclining or not, or reacting to reclining, as we just saw last week. Right?
The point of going back to that example is saying, you know, these sorts of massive coordination problems, the type of thing that you're suggesting, that in order to have the impact that we need from, say, getting our energy from renewable sources, many, many, many of us have to do it. One way that we could do that is through some sort of policy change that either mandates it or creates incentives for it. And there are incentives in place for solar. That's right.
A rule
or a regulation, right, or a material, right, incentive of some form. Another way to do it is just to take it into our own hands and make the change.
That would be more like the social contract kind of stuff. Idea that someone picks it on, it becomes trendy.
That's right. And, you know, we like to say it doesn't take an act of Congress to change your behavior. You know, there are lots of strategies, but we're essentially in the business of identifying strategies that help make these things work with emotional appeals that you're talking about, like pride. So building campaigns that really leverage emotional appeals, or developing programs like community solar projects. Oftentimes, in this case, a lot of these programs or solutions are more successful at the community level than, say, the whole countrywide. And so how can we scale up community level movements here in Chicago that says, you know, Chicagoans all believe that we should avoid meat on Mondays.
Sure, right.
You know, that's the sort of thing that can,
you know, what's fascinating, and we'll take a break here, but it makes me think about it, because you mentioned the meatless Monday kind of concept. Religion has played a big role in changing people's norms, behaviors, and whether it might be for avoiding sin or for what's going to happen right after Fat Tuesday and the idea of Lent. And there has been some organizations in our society, and religion is where you point to, that has created behavioral change. And it seems to me, when you think about, and I'm not saying that religion has to take the lead here, but it has in human history. You have seen,
sure,
other grouping, like you're talking about, communities sort of set the norms. And even if you're not a religious person, you're like, well, I'm, you know, in March, I'm not going to eat meat on Fridays, and even though you may not be Catholic.
Right.
And there,
right,
there seems to be this idea that we all want to kind of join that herd.
That's right. Religious institutions have been, you know, probably the most powerful cultural force in certainly the last couple thousand years of our history.
Yeah. Kevin Green is here, Vice President at Rare. He's a behavioral scientist. We're talking about climate change and behavioral and human behavior, really. The first half was climate change. The second half is how to be a better spouse. We're just kidding. I'm joking with you. The Critical Conversation series is produced at Spertus, the Spertus Institute on South Michigan Avenue. Tomorrow night, they're having their big event, limited tickets available. You can find that online. We'll take a quick break and more with Kevin Green here on 720 WGN. Kevin Green is my guest here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. 312-981-7200. Kevin's going to be part of a big panel discussion tomorrow night at the Spertus Institute, bringing in well-renowned climate change experts from all over the country to have this conversation. It's part of their Critical Conversation series. They do it every year. This is their third year they've done it. Great people. Limited tickets available, but it's down on South Michigan Avenue at Spertus Institute coming up tomorrow night. Kevin Green, Vice President at Rare. This is also the head of the Center for Behavior and the Environment, specializes in behavioral sciences. We're talking a little bit about going from awareness to changing behaviors. And I'm guilty of this. This is something that I feel guilty about in my life, that there are things I feel I've made a choice. I'm aware of the plan. I've watched the Al Gore movies. I'm ready to rock. I understand what's going on, and I want to make a difference. But I'm still at the point where I'm like, did I throw that piece of plastic in the wrong receptacle? That doesn't matter. And I feel like this is a this may be more of a therapy session for me than no. But the
I'm ready.
But the idea that, you know, sometimes I feel that I don't make a difference, or that my one little mistake doesn't really make a difference when we're talking about the planet.
We're gonna get you through this.
Thank you, buddy. Thank you. The one thing you hear about all the time, and even right now is a perfect time to talk about this, is it's election year, and they say, you know, one way for human behavior, one thing you can do to control is to vote. You've got to vote, and you can pick a candidate that's more in line with the policies that you like. But we live in a divisive time. That doesn't necessarily connect when it comes to how we all going to come together in human behavior to take on one issue. If one my favorite candidate likes one thing, sure as all get out that your favorite candidate's not.
Right,
there's a lot of difference. We seem to stick with that. After the election's over, we stick with who we are and attached to our favorite politicians. So how do we get past that, where it's not about who's on the left and who's on the right and who our favorite politicians were in election, and get past the idea that it's just about voting?
Well, you just hit on one thing, really interesting thing about why change is so hard, or one of the reasons change is so hard is you noted that we tend to stick to our guns when we've taken a particular position. And this is a really common feature of human behavior, that when we have said out loud that we think something, we really don't want to be perceived to be inconsistent. And so we tried really hard to kind of make it look like we're sticking to that. And that's another thing that can
is that is that from human history? Is that something that's new because of everything that's happened in the last 10 years, where we feel like you can go back and call out fake news or call out that you're a hypocrite because you said this and before? I mean, is that something that's always been innate with human history?
Well, you can think of a lot of reasons why it would be, why it makes sense from an evolutionary perspective, because in order to survive as an individual within the species, we've got to coordinate on a lot of things, and therefore we have to get other people to trust us. And so if we're seen as wildly inconsistent, then it's more difficult to cooperate with us. And so there's a lot of reasons why we wouldn't want to appear inconsistent within the herd. Mm-hmm. In our past. And that I think that explains some of that. But, you know, you brought up voting and the sort of argument that's quite common now that really nothing matters except for voting in the people that can drive the sort of massive systemic change that we require to survive this crisis. And for sure, we need massive systemic change to survive this crisis. So look, voting is really important. We all need to get out and demand more from our politicians and our government to solve the climate crisis. But as I said before, it doesn't take an act of Congress to change our behavior. And these days, an act of Congress is really hard to get.
Right. If that's what we're waiting on, we're doomed.
That's right. You know, and so there's a more powerful message here that we, the people, actually do have an impact. You know, your behavior matters. It has an impact. And changing your behavior might just lead to the sort of spillover we need to finally get the sort of policy change that'll make the biggest difference. And the other thing is that, you know, these sort of behaviors that I'm talking about, reducing food waste or eating relatively more plants or using green energy in your home, those sorts of things, you know, these behaviors really aren't political. You may be surprised to hear that. You know, we have our own research that polls people on climate change, and there's a pretty visible political divide in terms of their willingness to take action. But you take out the language on climate change, you just don't even mention climate change.
That
word. Or global
Again,
warming
we talked
or
about
like
those
that.
Words being
yeah,
trigger words.
That's right.
Right, right.
You take those out, you don't even mention them, and you just ask people about whether they'd be willing to install solar or reduce their food waste or things like that. And the responses don't really correspond to where they fall on the political spectrum. They just aren't politicized in the same way.
Hmm. You mentioned the word trust, and there seems to be a lot around that, and politics obviously plays a big role when we talk about trust and who you trust and what they're saying to you. But more often than not, trust is in the messenger. And we've seen over time, many people are you know, scratching their head of whether or not they should be listening to this messenger or that messenger, or is this one a kook? Is this one, you know, untrustworthy? How do you get past that when it comes to behavioral science, that we seem to want the information, but we're not sure we're trusting where it's coming from?
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is a common thing in marketing as well, right? The messenger matters so much, oftentimes as much or more than the message itself. And there's not really a way to get around that. You know, we use that strategy quite a lot in thinking about how we are providing the sort of information or the sort of messages that we need people to get through the right channels. And so sometimes that can be through key influencers, mm-hmm. like through religious institutions, mm-hmm. that you mentioned. But the essential piece of it is that you understand your audience, right? And so the science of human behavior is really fascinating, right? Because we have all these sort of stylized empirical facts about what people do in the real world. That doesn't actually tell us anything about how to design solutions to influence their behavior. And so we have to sort of combine this highly behavioral and social science driven approach with a really empathic design approach, where we put ourselves in the shoes of the people that we're trying to help inspire to change and understand their motivations. Because what I might assume about what's motivating you in the choices that you're struggling with in your life might be completely incorrect.
Well, there are companies for that. There are companies on Madison Avenue in New York City that do that.
Sure.
There are media companies that do that all the time on who specifically their audience is. So are you going to, if the idea is that we want to change human behavior, do you see a society, a future, whereas we have seen political ads nonstop? Maybe not in this market, but if you're in, I would assume in South Carolina this week, you're seeing nonstop people saying, this is what I believe in, this is what I'm for. And in Chicago, we've had it a couple times where there was a soda tax here that they wanted to put a tax on. So there was another tax. And the ads became about the issue, not about the politician. So it was in the same vibe where it seemed like it was, you know, someone, an attack ad on a politician, but it was an attack ad on an issue.
On the referendum.
You know, or issue, not even, yeah. it was just the issue. So do you see a future like that, where if you want to get human behavior to all come together and the idea be that maybe it's solar energy or maybe it's recycling, whatever it might be, that we use those kind of tactics, that it becomes marketing on TV?
It's certainly possible. I mean, you know, the marketers on Fifth Avenue, the tobacco companies and the soda companies and what have you have done better than anyone else at leveraging the science of human behavior almost on instinct or, you know, by accident to get us to buy things that aren't good for us. So a lot of those tactics, can and probably should be used for good. But there's more to it than that, right? There's more than messaging here when we think about what motivates the type of behavior change that we're talking about. There's the sorts of things that generate sort of community level change, mm-hmm. In more organic ways that can be really powerful. And so you start to think about, like, rather than covering the United States with advertising about climate change, what can we do here in Chicago? What do people in Chicago care about? And what will motivate them to adopt some massive scale change here in the city?
Regionality and has to play a role in human behavior, because you see this all the time and you hear it all the time that it doesn't really matter because what I do in the United States, it won't matter because what is happening in China or happening in Russia or happening in North Korea, they're not doing the same thing. They're not buying it. We tried the Paris Accord and it kind of all broke apart. But even so, we make a big change and a policy change to change the way we do energy here. We're all smart enough to know it's a whole planet. And there are other countries that are not doing that. So what do you say to that? When you're trying to, human behavior is beyond borders. How do we get people who don't speak the same language, don't have the same cultural values, don't necessarily see it as the same issues, to come together to change behavior?
Yeah, I mean, the climate certainly doesn't have any borders. The atmosphere doesn't care about a border wall or anything like that. We talked earlier about cooperation problems, and this is kind of the mother of all cooperation problems. How do we get a global community of many, many different decision-making bodies to coordinate to be able to adopt these changes? And it's the same sort of thing that has to happen on the airplane, right? It's the same phenomena. And so actually a lot of progress has, in spite of shortcomings and some governments like ours not performing on the Paris commitments, the commitments that almost all governments of the world 5 years ago made to reach net zero emissions by 2050. You know, even making that public commitment is an enormous first step in solving that coordination problem, because now they have completely eliminated plausible deniability. No government that made a commitment in Paris can then say we didn't know we were supposed change. And that's a big step.
But it's beyond
solving
to
a
me
coordination
to me. And let's take a quick break, because I want to come back and we'll have a little bit of time on the back end. Kevin Green is here, behavioral scientist, but he is part of RARE.org, the head of the Center for Behavior and the Environment. He's part of the Critical Conversation Series, which is at Burtis Institute on South Michigan Avenue tomorrow night. Limited tickets available. You can find them online. You're going to be tons of people in this panel discussion having a conversation about climate change. It's great to have you here, and we'll take a quick break, and we'll continue our conversation right after. So stay with us. Kevin Green is here. He's my guest at 720 WGN, a behavioral scientist who's also a member of RARE. RARE.org is the site. He's going to be part of the conversation on climate change at Spertus Institute tomorrow night, which will have a slew of great David Wallace Wells, who's one of the editors at New York Magazine. Bill McKibben. Tried to get Bill McKibben in here one time before. It didn't happen. So I get Kevin Green, who's we're having a great conversation tonight, 312-981-7200, about not just about awareness. It's almost like, in a way, I could tie it together. Say, Bill has done such a tremendous job of making people aware of what the issues are with our planet. And what we need to do is take that information and figure out how, as a society, to synthesize it, how to make it put it into action. And when you get to a point as a when you think about human behavior, that's just got to be so hard to think about. What I was getting at before the break was just this concept that it's one thing to tell the Chinese government or the French government or the United States government, we need zero emissions by 2050. It's another to get them to crack down on private interests, private business. Industrial fishing is a good example, and you've talked about this, the idea that they're just the consumers want the fish, they're going to fish. They don't care about the ecosystem of the planet. They're going to do it. So how it's not just about, because one part is going to be policy, but it has to be about something more. And I don't know how it, when you start getting into the economy and you start getting into people who it's the livelihood, or they're making, or maybe they're just making billions and billions of dollars off it. How do you get those change? How do you get those changes in behavior?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. You know, we're often presented with all of these sort of, I would say, false choices in thinking about how we address big, hairy environmental challenges like climate change or like global overfishing, which you mentioned. And there are different avenues that we sort of evaluate in terms of how to solve them. You know, policy on the one hand, or technological innovation is obviously a huge component of how we think about addressing the climate crisis, and certainly has a role to play. And of course, individual and household level behavior, which we're talking about. As I said, I think these are really oftentimes false choices, and in some ways, sometimes the whole can be greater than the sum of its parts. So if you think about a lot of the technological innovation, well, somebody has to actually adopt that technology. Now, it might be deployed at a massive government scale, but it might also be the sort of technology that is used at the household level. And so somebody's got to use it. A policy gets passed. The policy has to get actually implemented or used. And so if a new incentive is created, such as the tax credits that are available right now for instance, solar installation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a massive tax credit right now for installing solar on your home. And it's not going to last for, it doesn't seem like it's going to last forever. So I highly recommend it. You know, these things have to get adopted by people. And so they're all part and parcel of the same big picture. And if you look at sort of the behavioral piece of that triangle or of that diagram, it also has big knock-on effects then for what happens at the policy level and what happens at the technology level, what happens at the sort of industrial or corporate side, as you're referring to. So,
all those entities, whether it's me, the government, the huge industries, they all run by a different set of principles. And we're not, as human behavior, we talk about a human species, that we're not the same. I know that the Supreme Court will say a corporation and a person is the same, but we're not.
Right.
My decisions I make to say I'm going to up my game when it comes to composting or recycling or what it might be, it's not the same scale. And so how do you get everybody? I just don't know. And my despair in this conversation is a lot of the work that you do is to say, hey, as behavioral scientists, you look at these are the actions or these are the feelings and the emotions that come out of human beings about behavioral change. So you're seeing it right across the studio for me. Yeah. This idea that as I continue to try and be curious about this, I also find it to, this is never going to happen.
The struggle is real.
Kevin Green is my guest. Spertus Institute tomorrow night. Tomorrow night they're doing the critical conversation series at Spertus. What's the steps? Why don't we start there? We only have a couple minutes here, but what is one thing that we can do? People are listening to this program. It's not political. It's just to say, hey, you know what? If we all do this, it's a step in the right direction. It'd almost be like a project for all of us.
Here's what I would say to that. Here's what you can go do immediately. Wherever you are, choose the most ambitious thing that you can do, that you're capable of doing in whatever situation you're in to reduce your emissions. That might be avoiding meat one day of the week. That might be finding alternative transportation than driving your car. There are many different things like this that I'm talking about. It doesn't have to be significant as installing solar on your house or something like that. Choose the most ambitious thing that you can do to reduce your emissions and do it. And then do whatever it is and then tell your friends and your neighbors about it. Make sure that your friends and your neighbors know about it because that's where the real power from this comes from. When we make these behaviors more observable, we start to foment the sort of change that can happen at the scale that we need, right? People don't leave a burning building when they see smoke. They leave a burning building when they see other people leaving. And that's the sort of thing that we can create if we make these behaviors more observable. So do the most ambitious thing that you can do, but don't just do it. Make sure that your friends and your neighbors know about it.
Well, I would assume a powerful tool would be social media. I would assume for behavioral scientists, the idea of what you see happening on social media, positive and negative, is a pretty powerful tool.
For sure, yeah. I mean, social media is sort of this, maybe it's not a new frontier anymore. It still feels like a new frontier in how we communicate and get messages out in all sorts of surprising ways. But it's a way to communicate at scale very, very quickly, very cheaply. And so it's kind of revolutionized our ability to make behavior more observable.
And we're talking about less than 20 years at this point. So right. It is, as you see, human behavior change just the way that we have adopted our behavior to social media. Another thing that I thought about in this conversation, which is on a positive, is that, you know, I have my phone, which is obviously something that I've only had for a couple of years. But the idea that technology and technological innovation can happen like that in human history. It can happen in a way that if it wasn't a phone that that I'm holding in my hand, it could be something else, but the goal and the intent might be to get to this bridges concept, this idea of human behavior and climate change.
That's right. I mean, technology is an amazing thing, but the thing we have to remember about it is that for the types of technology that you're talking about, somebody has to use it, right? And it's how they use it. It's what they use it for that that we like to think a lot about. You know, we spend a lot of time, I think, churning the wheels about what sort of technology we need. But are we really thinking about the last mile when people are using that technology, how they're using it, whether they use it in the ways that we anticipate? That's where some of the real tricky issues come.
Yeah. As we wrap up here, when you look to the next 10, 15, 20 years and the work that you're doing, do you feel hopeful and optimistic about changing human behavior?
I do. Yeah, I feel I feel a lot of the things that a lot of people feel. I feel fear. I have two small children. I certainly worry about the future that they're going to inherit. But we are fundamentally a problem-solving species, and with incredible capacity to coordinate and cooperate and solve big challenges. And I think we have an obligation to feel hopeful and to try to actualize that hope
as best we can, knowing that no future is going to be perfect, but you know, what's the point if we're not going to try?
We're not going to try. You sound like a Little League coach. What's the point if we're not going to try? So, where can we find out more information about Rare?
Just as you said, you can go to rare.org. If you go to rare.org/climate, you can find out a lot about some more of the stuff that I've been talking about, what these sorts of behaviors are that can really have a big impact, and find more out about.
And in this panel discussion tomorrow, because when you read the names that are associated, who are you most interested in sitting next to? If you're in a position where you got the jockey, who would be the person you'd want to sit next to?
It's such a hard question to answer, because you've got you know, Bill McKibben, who, you know, he popularized some of the thinking on climate change when it was just some atmospheric scientists who were sitting around trying to figure out what the hell was going on, and he kind of brought it to the popular culture. And so, you know, 15, 20 years ago, I picked up his book, and it had a tremendous impact on me. So, you know, it's just an honor to be on stage with him. You know, everybody's doing some really great stuff. Katie Milkman, I just happen to be a big fan of hers because she's also a behavioral scientist. She hosts a really cool podcast, Choiceology, which I recommend for folks who are interested in learning more about behavioral science. Really, everybody's going to be awesome.
Great.
So I'm just going to try to listen.
There you go. Kevin Green is the vice president at Rare. He's also the head of the Center for Behavior and the Environment, and he'll be part of the panel discussion tomorrow night at the Spertus Institute, part of their Critical Conversations series. This one will be on climate change. And again, Spertus is down on South Michigan Avenue. There are limited tickets available, and you can find those online if you just search Spertus Institute and Critical Conversations. Kevin, a pleasure. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. Ted McClellan's going to be with us coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, our resident linguist and partner in crime when it comes to the Chicago Accent Challenge. 312-981-7200. If people tell you you got a good Chicago accent, or, oh, you have an accent, just that alone can win you a prize. 312-981-7200. You can get lined up now if you have that accent. And Ted and I will ask you a couple of very precise, very specific questions that will suss out said accent. That's what we're doing in the 9 o'clock hour coming up next. And at 10 o'clock, Sam Panionovich will be in studio, and we'll talk a little bit about the Chicago Blackhawks trade deadline, which was a big story today, and also cover what might happen with the Bulls front office, and of course, spring training, which the Cactus League started on Saturday. All that coming up tonight here on 720 WGN. But first, let's get to Vic Vaughn's news, which is next, and Ted McClellan is standing by in our PPG Paints green room for the Chicago Accent Challenge. Stay with us. 312-981-7200. You're going to want to know that number tonight, because it's time for the Chicago Accent Challenge right here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. The Chicago Accent Challenge has been made famous by super fans, the Bulls. But there's much more to our local dialect than Bears and Bulls. It's nuanced, and according to region, ethnicity, gender. 312-981-7200, and it's time for the Chicago Accent Challenge. It's simple. We get contestants on the line. Best accent wins a prize, but that's not all. The winner gets the opportunity to play in a bigger tournament we'll talk about later. So if you have been told you got the best Chicago accent on the block, or you use phrases like drag it through the garden or over by dare at least once a week, you've got a good chance to win something tonight. You call up, we interview a little bit, we read a couple things, some other fun stuff, and boom, your night is made. How do I know this? Because I've read my next guest's book, Ted McClellan, back tonight. He's the author of How to Speak Midwestern, a writer at Chicago Magazine, our resident linguist. Ted, good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you, Justin.
This is one of my favorite hours to do, and it's so great to have Ted here. 312-981-7200. This really does stem from conversations we had from your book, How to Speak Midwestern, because the Chicago accent is an interesting accent. It's come from different parts of this country.
Well, I like to say it's layered with local history, you know, because the basic Chicago accent, the building block of the Chicago accent, it comes from Western New England, Western New York, which is where the first Chicagoans emigrated from. They got on a ship in New York and they crossed the Great Lakes and landed here. So if you go to Buffalo, the accent is actually very similar to where the way it is in Chicago. We talk more like people from Buffalo than we do
Wisconsin, like,
or Peoria.
Or Peoria. You know,
people in our own state. And then, you know, you got the influence of the immigrants. That's where the whole D's, Dem, and Do's thing came in, because English is one of the very few languages with the TH sound. And, you know, it's a big player in English. This, that, them, the other thing. And the people who came here, they weren't used to making that sound, and they would
put the duh.
The duh, and it kind of got passed down through the generations.
Does it matter because Chicago is a huge, and we're going to talk about this because Fat Tuesday's tomorrow.
Right.
Does it matter that Chicago is a huge immigration population, mostly Polish? Does a Polish have something to do with the Chicago accent?
I think Polish-Irish, I think, has a lot to do with it. Because even the Irish, you know, they would talk about, Turdy Tree. Even they wouldn't do it because they had to switch from their language to English, and they brought that over. The Irish is where yuz came from, because, you know, English is one of the few languages that doesn't have that second person plural, and the Irish had it in Gaelic, and when they switched to English, they said, well, we need this, so they just added an S to you.
Right,
and I still hear that. I was walking down the Western near 95th once with a friend, and we were just kind of looking around, and this guy's like, are you lost?
Right, there it is, right?
But you talked about race, too. Chicago, the Midwest, has a very, in the country, has the highest what you call accent segregation. So,
really?
You know, African Americans are not doing the super fans accent.
So they're split. So as much as we're segregated along racial lines, were also segregated along accent lines.
Yeah, because, you know, they were isolated in the Black Belt, and they didn't have much social contact with whites, so they, in a lot of ways, just kept
the Southern accent.
The Southern speech, they'll still say y'all.
Right, right. 312-981-7200. Do you have a Chicago accent? You have a chance to play for some prizes. Ted and I will read you some questions, and you'll give us some answers. And we also want to know, and this is something for the callers, because some people have texted in, but it doesn't work on text. Since tomorrow is Fat Tuesday, we want to know, how do you pronounce the Polish jelly donut?
Yes.
That is very synonymous with Fat Tuesday.
Starts with a P.
Starts with a P, but we don't want to say anything else.
Right. We want to hear how you pronounce it, because I've heard a couple different pronunciations.
There you go. 312-981.
And we want to know where you get yours.
Yeah, and where you get it.
What your favorite flavor is.
A lot of questions we have for you before Fat Tuesday tomorrow. 312-981-7200. So what is, you talked a little bit about the use and some other things, but what are the characteristics? Is it the vowel? It's a long vowel?
Chicago, it's in what you call the Inland North, I guess you call accent or dialect region, which goes pretty much from Western New York all the way to Milwaukee, most of the Great Lakes cities, Cleveland, Detroit, Milwaukee, Chicago. So there's something going on. It's called the Northern Cities Vowel Shift, and it's sort of it's actually said to be the biggest change in English vowel pronunciation in 1,000 years.
Wow.
It's happening right here in the Midwest. And I think one of the biggest things is it's that A sound. You say can.
And.
Can or and. Yeah, or, you know, super fans, you know, Chris Ryder always say, you know, that's right, Bob, that's right. So it's that A sound. It moves from the front of your mouth to the back.
Yeah,
to the
right,
back.
Right, to the back.
And then the O sound moves up to take its place. So that's where you get sausage. You know, that's where you get
interesting.
Box.
Box.
Yeah.
That's so great.
It's a chain shift.
All right, there we go. 312-981-7200. Why don't we take one or two calls before we take our first break, just to get us in the mood? Let's start with Debbie. Debbie, welcome to Chicago Accent Challenge. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good.
Hi,
so what made you call in? You there? Did we lose her?
Maybe.
Oh, no. Well, that was a bummer. That could have been a good start. So let's go to John. John, welcome to Chicago Accent Challenge. How are you, John?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Hi, thanks for calling. What made you tonight say, you know what, I'm going to call in?
Well, I wasn't even listening to the radio. A buddy of mine called. He told me, hey, you got to call up WGN and get on his accent and challenge things. So that's right. What I did.
You're known
see
to
what
be,
happens.
You're known to be the guy with the accent
you
in your
you
career.
You already said a key Chicago phrase, which is a buddy of mine.
So you're the guy. Okay. So you feel like you're the guy with the accent in your crew?
I think I am. I really don't know. I can't tell. My daughter goes to Ball State, and everybody tells her that she's got a weird accent. They don't know where it's from. Uh-huh. But she keeps telling them that she's from Chicago, and then they kind of like, oh yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So,
now, do you celebrate Fat Tuesday?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
And what do you eat on Fat Tuesday?
Well, we punchki.
There you go.
There it is. Right
where do you get your punchki?
Well, I get my punchkis from Weber's.
Okay,
Weber's.
Weber
right.
Bakery and Archer.
All right, great. And where are you from? Chicago? What parish?
I'm from St. Joe's. I was originally from back of the yards.
Uh-huh.
48th and Hermitage. I grew up 52nd and Henry. My parish is St. Joe's.
You're
the neighborhood of bars and churches.
I was going to say, John, your entire, right there, everything you just said, Ted's face lit up. He's like, we've got the Chicago accent on the line. Everything about it.
Now, Justin had a question for you having to do with the upcoming snowstorm.
Okay, so there's rumors of a big snowstorm coming through. So my question for you, John, tonight is what is your preferred dib?
My preferred dib.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Okay, so
what do you like to put out in the street to reserve your space after you've shoveled?
Oh, you know, usually a lawn chair.
Yeah.
It's a old classic. Lawn chairs, white plastic chairs, whatever we got left over from the summer.
Uh-huh.
You go with the summer stuff from the garage, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You're not using it for anything else.
We kind of throw it out there.
Yeah.
My neighbors take it. They throw it back on my lawn, and then they park in my spot, and then... We do the same thing to each other, and it's just kind of like a game, you know?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Are you Polish?
I am.
All right,
am.
So you probably know the answer to this. What is one punchki called?
One punchki?
Yeah.
Jeden punchki. Jeden.
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 Okay. But there's like, if you just have one of them, what's it called?
I'm
not arguing with that.
Wow.
Yeah.
John, that was awesome.
Yes.
That's pretty great. All right. So I'm going to put you on hold, John, and we'll get your information down. This is a contest for the hour. And okay. If you win, you're going to get a prize. So thanks for calling
right.
in.
Oh, John, great. John has
great
set
job.
A
you set a you
high
set
bar.
A,
this
a
is
high
like
bar.
The 29-foot right. long jump. You're really going to have to... Bring your game.
The Carl Lewis of the Chicago Accent Challenge is set to field. 312-981-7200. We got Jerry's on the line. Debbie's on the line. People calling in here.
Oh, Debbie's back.
Yep.
Right.
Chicago Accent
All right,
Challenge.
We got to get Debbie back.
We'll get Debbie right after the break here on 720 WGN. I would say Robin Baumgarten's got a pretty good Chicago accent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I did something for Chicago Magazine, the Chicago Accent Hall of Fame, and I was actually looking for a Bonnie Hunt clip. And I found Bonnie Hunt talking to Robin Baumgarten, and Robin Baumgarten just trumped her. I think she's from like Burbank.
Yeah,
you know that's total accent country.
There you go.
And you know she's stayed in Chicago, and Bonnie Hunt went to Hollywood.
She went to Hollywood. But,
yeah.
312-981-7200 Chicago Accent Challenge. Ted McClellan is here. He's the author of How to Speak Midwestern. He's also our resident linguist on this program to give us a better idea of the Chicago Accent Challenges or Chicago accents that are calling in. Let's go to Jerry. Jerry, standing by. Jerry, you want to play the Chicago Accent Challenge?
Yeah, I will because I'm originally from Chicago.
Oh, I like that.
Oh, yeah. See, you got the pronunciation right, Justin.
Yeah.
So
okay.
We've been talking about you keep saying Chicago and. All our callers say Chicago.
She says it the right way.
Yeah, you say
and,
it the
and
right
turn
way.
Down your radio if you can, because we're getting a little bit of an echo if you have it on.
Okay.
Yep. There we go. She'll turn that down, then we'll get started.
All right.
Okay.
All right, Jerry, so do you have people who say to you, hey, you've got a Chicago accent?
Yeah, we have some friends from New York who tell us that. Not that they have a New York accent, right?
Okay, so let's get into it. First of all, it is of course Fat Tuesday, and so
right.
Do you feel like you have a good pronunciation on the Polish pastry?
Well, yeah, we've always called it just punchki.
Yeah.
However, yesterday we were listening to Dean Richards, and a Polish lady who could really speak the language called in and said punchki is like a plural. And then she said one punchki would be, and I didn't catch the ending of it. So
I think it's
I didn't know there was a plural
Pacek.
And a singular.
I think it's Pacek, P-A-C-Z-E-K.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay. We had the guy beforehand. He He said it, but I think we missed a little bit of it because we don't speak Polish.
Yeah.
Right, right. Yes, I understand that.
Yeah. Well, okay. Where do you get your punchki?
Well, tomorrow, we live west and south of the city, but our neighbor is going to wander into Joliet tomorrow and bring back a whole carload from one of the bakeries in Joliet called the Donut Hole.
And what's your favorite flavor?
Probably strawberry.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good flavor.
Although, you know, my mom used to make them and my aunt did, but they really didn't put a lot of filling inside. Theirs was mainly the dough part, you know, fresh dough and small. I mean, now they're getting bigger and bigger, but they were small little things. But
So are you Polish yourself?
Yeah.
Okay.
Second generation, yeah.
All right. Do you speak Polish as well as John did, who called?
No.
No?
No. Just a few words here and there.
All right, so let's do this, Jerry. Let's get some questions on the line for you. So I'll give you the go-to. This is the question we ask a lot. And are you ready for it? Here we go.
Okay.
Welcome to Portillo's. May I take your order?
Chopped salad, the beef sandwich with green peppers, and probably a slice of chocolate cake.
Okay, all right. All right, all right. Let me try another one on you. Here's a question. It's really a classic Chicago question. How do you get over by Ma's?
How do I get over by Ma's? Well, when we lived in the city, we took Austin Avenue and went straight north, and we turned on Armitage to LaPorte, and then we went north on LaPorte, and that's where Ma was.
Right. Now, this may not be a big issue for you. You live in the suburbs now?
Right.
So we got a snowstorm coming up, but you did live in the city at one time.
Correct.
When you lived in the city, what was your favorite dib? What was your favorite object to use to reserve a spot?
To hold a parking space?
Yeah.
Probably a chair, an old chair.
Okay.
Although we have had, what do they call it, when the carpenters use them to
cut
wood on.
Yeah, that's a good one.
We put that out, too.
My favorite, I saw a picture of somebody who had a complete table setting. Did you ever see that?
Yeah, so good, yeah. My classic for me is two paint cans and a 2x4. That's a classic, right?
That's right on there.
That's an improvised song.
Yeah, there you go. Jerry, thanks so much. Good job.
Okay, well, enjoy your show, and you make it nice and bright.
There you go. Thanks, Jerry.
Right.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye. That's a nice thing to say.
Yeah.
Nice and bright. 312-981-7200. Jerry was good. She had some strong. You could hear the Chicago in her accent
for
sure.
You could hear those vowel sounds.
And she was all over the controversy over what the what the singular is for punchki.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I've seen it a couple ways. So punchki, or punch, like almost like a pound, like an OU, but it's punchki.
Punchki. Punchki. But we've had two in a row, and they're both.
They're Polish, and
they say punchki.
They say punchki.
So I think we're getting a consensus here.
All right, let's go. Debbie is on the line. Debbie, welcome back. I think we lost you last time.
Hi, Debbie.
Yeah, fine. How are you doing, Justin?
Good, good. So you know the name of the Polish pastry?
I do.
How do you pronounce it?
It could be punchki, but we also say punchki.
Punchki. Right. And do you get into the plural or singular punchki?
No, I've never. Until you said it on the radio, yeah. I've never heard of that
either. And I know, I know that because I saw that today, and I was actually, it's funny because I was questioning my own pronunciation of it, so I looked it up.
Yeah.
And there was a guy on a YouTube video, and he went through all of the different varieties in which ways you could say it, and how many there are in the plate, and things like that. And I just shut it off. I was like, "That's too much."
Never heard that before.
All the different ways to pronounce Chicago.
Exactly. All right, so Debbie, you want to play the game?
Sure.
There's that Chicago enthusiasm that we love so much. All right, so where are you from, Debbie?
I live in Chicago, but I moved away at 13 years old, so I lived there until I was 13.
Okay. Do you feel like the accent has followed you?
Not really. I haven't had anybody in a long time say you sound like you're from Chicago.
Where do you live now?
They might. In the suburbs, like Clarendon Hills.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. There's some strong Chicago accents in the suburbs. Go to LaGrange Park. Go to Burbank.
Oh, yeah. Right? I mean, I've heard them. I've heard them, but I don't feel mine is strong. I've been away for too long. There's occasional words like, I don't know why, I used to say a lot, like when you're referencing somebody like boy, you know, and just something like that I think we did a lot in Chicago.
I don't even think this is Chicago, but my wife has given me a lot of heck these days because I keep going, boy, oh, boy.
Oh, geez. Yeah, I don't know.
That's Midwestern.
I don't even know what that is, but I'm like, I don't know why I keep saying, boy, oh, boy. All right, so, Debbie, let me ask you a couple questions here, all right? You ready?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So we'll start with, welcome to Portillo's. May I take your order?
Hot dog with everything and fries.
I love it. Okay, good. All right, I'll ask you the same question we asked. The snowstorm's coming. Obviously, you live out in the suburbs, so this isn't as important to you. But if you lived in the city, what would be your preferred dib?
Well, I mean, I lived there where we were through one of the bad storms. So the storm of 67?
Yeah,
right. The number one storm, yeah. And you didn't have to save a spot, that's for sure. The snow was like a foot high, so that wasn't an issue. But mostly it would be like an old chair.
Old chair.
I think on occasion my dad would use probably the sawhorses with a piece of wood through it.
Yeah, that's good.
To save the spot.
Yeah, right? That's good. Okay.
Same as the other caller.
All right. Okay. I'm going to ask you a couple of trivia questions, okay? So these are going to be questions.
Okay.
So these are questions that you just answer if you know. And so it's Chicago questions. In the movie The Blues Brothers, who were Jake and Elwood on a mission from?
Chicago police?
That's who they were on the run from.
That's who they were on the run from. Who was the mission from? They kept telling you they were on a mission from.
We're on a mission from.
I don't remember. I'm sorry.
A deity that we.
That's where it gets fun. A deity that we all worship in church on Sunday.
I just don't remember.
The answer,
what was the question?
The answer is it was just say God.
I just realized what you had asked. Okay, yeah, God.
God, okay, right. That. We're just going for the vowel sign and God.
Yeah.
A long way to get there. I love it. All right, Debbie, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Debbie.
That's pretty good. I mean, she's got that Chicago. At least she had the enthusiasm at the front, right?
Yeah.
And hers is a little bit more muted than maybe what we heard from earlier.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think John and Jerry are still leading the pack.
All right. We've got Chris is on the line. We've got Tom who wants to take the challenge. A ton of texters as well. They're texting in about punchki.
Okay.
And what the singular and the plural.
What are they saying?
Well, we'll get to that. That's what we're going to do.
It's
a little teaser in the business, Ted. Oh. Ted McClellan, How to Speak Midwestern, is our guest. Chicago Accent Challenge is on the air here. If you think you got a good Chicago accent and you could beat John, who had a great one to start, you can win a prize tonight. So stay with us here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200, Chicago Accent Challenge here on 720 WGN. Justin Coffin with Ted McClellan, who is a linguist who speaks fluent Midwestern.
Yes.
Not just Chicagoan, but also Illinois and Wisconsin, Iowa,
Missouri, Minnesota. I'm going later this week to check out, there's a Midwesterners for Klobuchar headquarters on Broadway. And she's the only candidate for president with a hot dish recipe.
That's right.
Tater tot.
That's very Minnesota.
Topping.
Right. 312-981-7200 is our phone number, and we're playing for a prize tonight if you got the best Chicago accent. So let's get right back into it. Let's go to Tom, who wants to take the challenge. Tom, welcome to the Chicago Accent Challenge.
Hey, how's it going?
It's good.
Hi,
thanks for calling in. Why'd you call in?
I'm a Chicagoan, 100% Polish. You know, right. I was going to say with that punchki, it's punchek.
Yes. Thank you for the correct pronunciation. All right.
Yeah, it's punchki for plural and punchek for the single.
Nice. Tom, right. where are you from, Tom?
Southside.
Nice. Southside, what parish?
St. Fabian's.
Okay.
All right, there you
go. That's in Bridgeview.
Okay. And where are you going to go tomorrow to get your punchki?
I'm going to go definitely to Weber's.
Okay.
Weber's is a popular spot.
We had two votes for Weber's.
Yeah, Weber's is a place to go.
How long is the line going to be there?
There's going to be a line and a half.
Yeah.
Definitely a line and a half.
All right, so what's your favorite flavor?
You know what? The raspberry.
Yeah?
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. I like that. All right. Let me ask you a couple questions here. We'll get it going, Tom. All right, Tom, welcome to Portillo's. May I take your order?
Yeah, let me get a beef with extra wet and spicy.
All right.
That was the best ordering of all time. The ah in the middle, that's how you order. You don't. Everyone's got it right, and they're perfect. I'm like, you get in that drive-thru, there's a little bit of performance anxiety, and you're like, I'll take the fries. All right, so let me ask you the next question. How you get over by Maz?
You take 79th all the way to Harlem, and then go left on Okito.
There you go.
All right.
There's not a the only acceptable answer to that question is Harlem. There, yeah. Harlem is Harlem. Every single one that we do. How you get over by Maz?
Well,
Harlem
is
shows
like
up
right off Harlem.
Is it?
Yeah. What neighborhood is that? 79th and Okito.
That's Bridgeview.
Okay.
There you go.
Oh, it's in Bridgeview. So with the big snowstorm coming up, what's your favorite dib? What's your favorite object to put in the street to reserve your spot?
Come on, a bucket or a chair.
Okay. A bucket or a chair. We'd also accept old water heater.
Yeah, sure.
A furnace, right?
Yeah, right, a furnace. That's what you keep them around for, right? All right, I got a good one for you. I got a good one for you, Tom. All right. Name a famous local Dennis. D-E-N-N-I-S. Not dentist, but Dennis.
A famous Dennis?
Yeah.
From Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have three acceptable answers for you.
All right. Or three. Okay. I would say
famous.
Mm-hmm. A famous Dennis.
A Dennis from Chicago, huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He could be an actor. He could be an athlete.
A singer.
Yeah, a singer.
Not Dennis Leary, right?
No, he's from Boston.
He's from Boston.
Yeah. All right.
Farino?
Yeah, there you go.
You got it. Farina.
Yeah.
We'll take Farina. Farina's close enough. Yeah. It's Chicago. I would have taken Farina, Franz, or DeYoung.
DeYoung. Not Savard or Rodman.
Savard or Rodman, too.
Yeah.
Five.
Yeah.
There you go.
Rodman's from Chicago.
No, he played here.
He played here, yeah.
He
won three championships here, so we'll take it.
I know that.
Savard is from Quebec, so.
Tom, thanks, buddy. That was great.
Awesome, awesome.
All right,
Tom.
Thanks, buddy.
Have a nice one, man.
Yep, you too. Thanks for calling in. He's good.
I think he may be in the lead for giving us
the
pronunciation of a Punchek.
That was extra points for sure.
Yeah, because I wasn't sure on that myself.
The Tom's accent is a little bit more boisterous than John's. John had a little bit more, like it felt like an authentic Chicago, but Tom was
gravitas.
Yeah, but Tom was, he was in it.
Yeah, I think
it's gonna be a tough call.
Yeah, he's got a little bit of the D's, them, and don't.
All right, let's keep going. Let's do Christopher. Christopher, welcome to Chicago Accent Challenge. How are you, man?
Good evening. How are you?
I'm
Tom
good.
Kind of beat me to my thing. I was going to go into detail about Punchek and Punchki.
Oh, you had it right.
He got the basics right, although his Polish pronunciation leaves a little bit to be desired.
Okay, give us the pronunciation.
We're open to, perfection, correction.
The singular would be Punchek.
More Punchek than Punchek.
And there's it's not really an N. It kind of just goes nasal. French has a similar pronunciation. Ponchek and Ponchki.
Mm.
And there's a version of that vowel with the E. The A has a little tail on it, and the E has a little tail on it. The A is pronounced on, the E is pronounced L.
Mm-hmm. So I take it you're Polish?
Well, I was born in Chicago, but I grew
Polish
up
ancestry.
Speaking Polish.
Yeah. And you speak Polish?
I do, yes. Yeah.
Chris, where do you live?
In Rogers Park now.
Nice, okay.
Okay. All right. So where do you get your Punchki?
I tend not to indulge, I'm afraid.
Oh.
Sometimes if Ma makes a batch, I'll have a batch there from my Ma.
Yeah.
You see, I love how you just, Christopher, you got such an elegant voice. That's a very Chicago voice you have, but you knew to turn it on for Ma. That's good. All right, so let me ask you a couple questions, Christopher. Welcome to Portillo's. May I take your order?
I just came here with a friend, and I really wasn't going to have nothing but a Diet Pepsi. You guys, are you guys Diet Pepsi or Diet Coke?
What do they have at Portillo's?
I think it would Coke.
I think it's probably Coke.
It's probably Coke, yeah.
Yeah.
But that's still good.
Forget about it.
All right.
So here's a question that we haven't even asked anybody. We should be asking. How do you feel about people eating punchki not on punchki day? I mean, now they're selling it all week. They're selling it a week in advance. Is that right?
Hey, in our family, they made them all year round. Forget about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
There you go. There you go. All right.
You don't need no special occasion for punchki. Come on.
All right. I'm going to give us your best home run play-by-play call using your favorite player of all time from Chicago, either Cubs or Sox. Ready?
All right. I'll do what I can.
All right, here we go. Right. Go.
There's the pitch. Thomas swings. Oh, and this one is not long for this world, ladies and gentlemen. Chalk up another one for Frank Thomas.
There it is. Good job. Yes, Christopher. I'll take that all day. That was great. This one is not long for this world. Great job. Thanks, Christopher. How about that? You got to give him extra points for that, right?
Right. Absolutely.
I love it. And he was able to go and take a very, what I thought to be a very well-mannered Chicago accent and turn it on, put it on thick with the Diet Pepsi stuff.
I like his home run call much better than Ed Farmer's.
Don't tell Ed that, right? All right, let's go to John. John standing by. John, you ready to play Chicago Accent Challenge?
I am. I'm actually in it for the Poncheck part of the conversation been going on. I don't know that I can compete with these thick accents.
Yeah.
All right. So are you
Polish yourself, John?
I am. I'm born in Chicago, born in back of the yards.
Okay.
So Ponchki is correct. Ponchki is not correct. There's no S at the end. It's already plural.
Right.
And the singular of it is Poncheck. And yes, it's that sound, but most Americans would be better served by just saying it as if it were spelled P-U-N-C-H, punch, and then key, K-E-Y, Ponchki.
Because Americans
that would be much closer.
Because Americans can't really get the nuances of the Polish pronunciation.
No, that will be much closer than punchki. What it's
punchki.
How well do you speak Polish?
Fairly. I can get by.
Could you say my mom makes the best punchki in Polish for us?
Moja mama robi najlepsze punchki w całym świecie.
Ah, that's great. That's awesome. John, where do you go tomorrow? Where's the spot you're going to go to get the punchki?
I'm going to go to Racine Bakery on Archer Avenue.
Racine Bakery. All right. Sounds great, John. Awesome. Thanks for calling in, man. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right. There you go. This is getting too good, man.
everybody calling in is Polish.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
They're giving all of Chicagoland.
Tomorrow's their day.
Yeah.
So they should have this.
Let's go to Spiro. Spiro's on the line. Spiro, you ready to play Chicago Accent
I'm
Challenge?
I'm guessing Spiro's not Polish.
I'm definitely not Polish. Greek all the way.
Yeah.
So I'm not up for the challenge. There's no way I'm going to win it, but I do have a story to share.
Let's hear the story.
Yeah.
So I lived in Asia for a long time in Hong Kong. That's a whole other reason, but anyway, I was there for a long time. I cannot tell you how many people came up to me and said, "You're from Chicago, aren't you?" And we're talking about people that are British, Australian, New Zealand, even Asians in general. Because I had such a thick Chicago accent. This was like 20 years ago. It's not the case any longer. But anyway, my comment, the thing that I want to tell you guys, is every time I said that, I don't have an accent. I just speak English the way it's meant to be spoken.
Yeah. Well, what do you think?
Silence on their end.
What do you think gave it away to people? What do you think gave away your Chicago origins?
So I'm from Aurora. So, you know, I can't even say I'm from the city. But I don't even know. It was like one of the first callers that said, I don't even know how I speak. It's just that's how I sound, but they picked up on it. And I was amazed, because I never had anyone in the States tell me, you must be from Chicago, but overseas, it was just, I can't tell you how many times it happened.
I'm amazed that like a British person could identify an American regional accent.
Right.
Yeah, and it was always, you're from Chicago, not are you from Chicago? It was a statement, not a question. So I know I had it, definitely. Uh-huh. I think it's been watered down over the years.
I was going to say, where's that come from? Because it's not like watching The Untouchables or Al Capone would give you a Chicago accent.
Well, Al Capone was from Brooklyn.
So. Yeah, but that's my point. The idea, that's the only way people would know Chicago from Britain would
there
be
were,
the
There were no Chicago accents in The Untouchables.
Right.
Yeah. So even though you're not Polish, are you going to eat punchki tomorrow?
No, I'm not. No. I'm not. But anyway, I wanted to share that with you guys. Like I said, the classic response to anybody who says that, yes, I speak English the way it's meant to be spoken without an accent. I
love it.
Right.
Thank you, man.
With you guys.
Thanks for that story. Thank you. Appreciate it, man. Thank you very much.
There is the Greek Midwestern connection. They say opa, and we say ope.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. It's a Chicago accent challenge. 847 wants to tell you, Ted, that in Poland they started celebrating last Thursday.
Okay.
So some people call it Fat Thursday. That's why you've been seeing punchki all week.
Okay.
There you go.
I didn't know this punchki drift.
I had no idea. A 630 says, went to basic training in Alabama. My buddies in my company always called me out on my accent. There you go. Okay, so in our Polish household, punchki is plural. Punchek is singular. In Poland, punchki day is actually the Thursday before Fat Tuesday, so they start to sell it last Thursday, eating them through tomorrow, perfectly legit.
Okay.
It's like Mardi Gras and Italy's carnival being sold a solid week long.
Okay.
There you go. All right, 312-981-7200. Katie's up next. We'll take a quick break, and then we're going to get to her. And I also got some texts that want to weigh in on whether it should be John or Jerry. Who's the other? No, there was a Tom. John and Tom.
Right now, I got John and Tom at the
John
top.
And Tom. John and Tom at the top. But there's some questions in here that could help us sort out, because it's neck and neck right now. But Katie could steal it coming up here. And you could steal it, too, coming up right after the break. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Justin Kaufman here with Ted McClellan. How to Speak Midwestern is his book, and this is the Chicago Accent Challenge. We do it on Monday nights when Ted's available. 312-981-7200. We're having a ton of fun tonight.
Yes.
A perfect night for it as tomorrow.
Punchki Day is tomorrow.
As someone asked, what do punchki have to do with Mardi Gras?
Right.
And it's just every culture has their thing the day before Lent.
It's the big indulgence before Lent.
Right.
You know, you eat this pastry that's, what, like 700 calories, you know?
Right.
They had a contest in Hamtramck, which is a town that it actually used to be Polish. Now it's mostly Muslim, but it's historically Polish. They had a contest. I think someone ate 21 punchki in 15 minutes. Can you imagine
that? That's the plural, punchki.
You wouldn't have to eat for all the rest of Lent.
Oh, what are you giving up for Lent? Punchki. Yeah, it's because you just ate 21 of them.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Katie. Katie's been standing by. Katie, welcome to Chicago Accent Challenge. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Where are you from?
Hi, Katie.
I'm from Chicago. I swear, I actually am, not the suburbs.
What's your parish?
St. Mary Starcy.
Okay.
Which one?
St. Mary Starcy Parish.
Okay.
Wow. Katie, I'm impressed with your accent already.
Me too.
a very distinct voice. Do people tell you all the time you got a very Chicago accent?
Oh, yeah. I'm like at college right now, and every time I talk to someone, they're like, where the hell are you from? And I'm like, I'm Chicago.
Are you out of state?
Where are you going to college?
I go to Indiana. It's Ball State in Muncie, Indiana.
Okay. Right, now, do they observe Punchki Day in Muncie?
No, they don't.
No. But back home... Yeah. Where did you get your punchki?
I get it from Weber's Baker.
Okay, yeah, that's number three votes. And what's your favorite flavor? Favorite filling?
I kind of like the cream cheese filled one, honestly.
Oh, that's pretty good.
I mean, you got to get all the junk food you can before, right?
Yeah, that's right.
All right, I'm going to ask you a couple questions, Katie. We'll start with welcome to Portillo's. May I take your order?
Hi, can I get an Italian beef sandwich dipped with red sauce and hot peppers?
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
It's hard to argue with how great this accent is. I'll be honest with you. Katie, how do you get over by Ma's?
Over to my mom?
Yeah, how do you get over by Ma's?
Ma's isn't like my mom?
Like how do you drive to your Ma's house?
In my car?
What route do you take?
Yeah. I don't know. I still live with my mom.
Yeah, all right. So it's probably not going to work with her.
I think you get an idea of
right.
who usually is listening to this program. They're going to be like, I take Harlem over to 290. But you're like, I live with my mom, so that works.
Yeah,
out.
No, I still live with her. I could go to my aunt's house, though.
Yeah, there you go. How do you get over to your aunt's
house? By your aunt's?
Okay, so I take Central to 63rd Street, and then I take that down to her main block. And then it's right there to the right.
All right, good. All right, this is great. All right, so when it's snowing, big snowstorm coming through Chicago. You and your family, when you're shoveling out your parking space, what is your preferred dib that you put into the parking space?
Probably the foldable chairs.
Yeah.
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 That's a strong one.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry we can't send you some Punchki to Muncie.
That's all right.
Every Chicagoan should have one.
All right, I have a couple for you. All right, I got a couple questions for you. I'm not letting you off the hook. This is too good of an accent.
Okay.
All right, here we go.
All right.
Okay. What's the name of the tallest building in Chicago?
Sears Tower.
Yeah. Wow. This is going to be tight. She's solidifying my vote right off the bat.
You got to do the Blues Brothers question.
Yeah. In the Blues Brothers, you seen that movie?
I sure have.
Okay. Who were Jake and Elwood on a mission from?
God.
Boom.
All right. Good. All right. I'm going to give you a tough one here, okay? Give me the last name of this Chicago family, the Chicago royal family. You ready? I'm going to give you some first names. Bill, John, Joel, and Brian Doyle.
You might have got me on this one.
Okay.
Hold on.
They're Chicago royal family. They're celebrities. Bill, John, Joel, Brian Doyle.
I'll give you a hint. They're actually from Wilmette.
Yeah, I don't know about people from Wilmette.
Okay, the Murrays.
The Murrays.
It would be the Murrays.
Yeah.
So Bill Murray. You know Bill Murray,
the guys who did Caddyshack.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, my last question for you would be, who is the greatest baseball team? Which is the greatest baseball team in Chicago?
The Chicago White Sox.
Right. Of course. We got a South Sider on the line
here. This is great. You were great. Thank you. Yeah. Hold the line. Oh, man. I don't know.
We got to fill up this contest. Can we give it to more than one?
I've heard, and
we could have a male and a female division because you know the accents are kind of different here.
I think Tom is his accent was wonderful.
Yeah,
I think John's was distinct, but I've heard John's accent, and I've heard Tom's accent.
Right.
We rarely have people of different generations.
Right.
With such strong accents. And this is a female accent.
Right.
And it's got that, it's really that high Chicago accent, like the high register.
So you think that she should just get a millennial bonus for
being
a millennial with a strong Chicago accent?
I just think it's
accent.
Unique. I think that I've not heard too many Katies, especially at a younger audience.
I think
like
Tom sounded like a younger. He sounded like he was maybe in his 30s. Yeah. But
I don't know, man. That she got all the questions. She got the God.
I don't see any reason we can't invite more than one person. You know, we got to fill up this contest.
Well, let's check with Pete and make sure there's enough prizes to go around. There are two to go around.
Do we have?
All right, so there's two.
Oh, do we have prizes?
Yeah, we do.
Where are they?
I don't know. They're on the prize sheet. I don't have the prize sheet in front of me.
Nobody knows.
So
we could have gotten more callers if you.
No, there's two. We said there's two. Okay, there's two prizes.
I mean, so are they real prizes or are they things like you get in a Cracker Jack box?
It's probably, yeah.
Yeah.
The prizes are insignificant. The
temporary tattoo of your favorite
Ted,
Chicago
the ability
baseball.
For someone to say, I won at WGN Chicago Accent Challenge is prize enough.
Okay.
Right?
All right.
So let's just say, but there are prizes. Let's get between Tom and John.
All right, I would take Tom.
You take Tom. I like John. I thought John was a little bit more of a, he started it off, and I felt like he was a more... genuine, authentic Chicago accent.
Okay.
Not to say Tom wasn't, because he was great and he nailed a bunch of stuff. But that was a little bit more. Tom was a little bit more of the what we know to be the Chicago accent. John had a little bit less. Now, a caller pointed out 773, and maybe it was on how I asked the question, they also mentioned that John did not know what a dib was when we first asked, so he should be disqualified.
I guess I thought Tom would be more fun in the...
In a tournament?
In the live finals tournament. I think that's why I picked him.
All right. I think we got it, right?
All right.
I think that we say the winners tonight should be Tom.
Yeah.
We'll go with your guy. And Katie.
And Katie. Katie definitely.
Katie should win.
Has this. Yeah. Has it. Because I remember one time we did.
We did said two categories.
We were going to do male and female. Because, you know, there's a difference in the exit. There was actually a linguistic study that found that men. They studied steelworkers' families on the east side. Men were more likely to do that. That D's, them, and those thing, you know, because they just get together with their buddies. And
that's
talk
what
like
I mean.
That.
We've heard from a lot of women tonight, which is awesome. And usually, though, it's dudes.
Yeah,
usually it's dudes. So the idea that tonight we got Jerry, Debbie, and Katie.
Yeah,
and Katie, I mean, that is just the classic White Sox South Side.
When she said
Chicago accent,
I was like, boom, you know, you got it.
Even the confusion, like, how do I get to Ma's? What do you mean? Yeah. I live with Ma.
Yeah, I was kind of suspecting that. Yeah.
Another great Chicago accent challenge right before Fat Tuesday and Punchki Day, which is tomorrow.
Happy
and we
Punchki
found out
Day.
Tonight, happy Punchki Day. We found out tonight that the place that seems to be above
is Weber's.
Yeah.
And let me just, I think I had the, I think it was 70-55 Archer, but let me just.
70-55 Archer.
Let me just double check. Weber, 70-55 West Archer Avenue, right before Harlem.
There you go. That's where to get the. That's the winner of.
I'm guessing you're going to wait in line for an hour.
That's great. Ted McClellan is the author of How to Speak Midwestern. You can also find a great piece
line
in Chicago Magazine.
That's what Tom said.
Line and a half.
Line and a half.
Yeah. Ted McClellan, How to Speak Midwestern is his book. Also great stuff in Chicago Magazine. And he joins us regularly here for the Chicago Accent Challenge. A tremendous night. The winners, Tom and Katie. And we'll be back whenever. I think next Monday might be. I can't remember because I know the Blackhawks got a couple Mondays coming up. But we got to come up. Thanks, Ted. Good job. Right.
Thank you.
All right. That's wow, man. That was a great one.
That was.
It's always great when you get to.
Do the Blackhawks play on March 16th?
We'll find out. We'll find out. Yeah.
If we don't do it next week, we should definitely do it because that would be when we had the Punchki Day edition, we could have the St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah. Edition. Get the Irish in as well.
Get the callers from.
All right. Beverly. We'll make sure that happens. 312-981-7200. All right. Coming up, Sam Panionovich is going to be here. We'll talk with him about some sports stories, including the Blackhawks tonight, of course, after the day's deadline. And it's got some fans scratching their head about the trade of goaltender Robin Lehner, who was brought in as a star at the beginning of this season. It's already gone for a couple of second. Was it 1 second round draft pick? A couple of second round draft picks? Whatever it was. Fans are scratching their heads. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the Bulls. We'll talk about spring training coming up. With Sam Panionovich coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, 312-981-7200. Also, Dane Neal's in for Nick D tonight, just to let you know on that. Vic Vaughn's news is up next, and then Sammy will be in studio. We'll talk Chicago sports here on 720 WGN. All right, 312-981-7200, the phone number here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and joining me in studio, it's been a while since we've been on the air together, Sammy Panionovich. Sam, of course, a longtime sports guy in town and also worked here at WGN Radio. And we've had long conversations about sports in the past, and it's always great to have you, buddy.
It's good to be back. I was actually doing the math on the way here because before I left to Vegas, you were the last guy I went on with, and that would have been January of 2018. Mm. And a lot has happened since then. You know, I don't do sports anymore. I don't talk sports anymore. You know that, right?
You don't?
No. What are we doing? What are we talking about tonight?
You've matured.
No, you know what? I'm joking, obviously, but you know what's funny? These last 10 months, I've put the sports, like when I get home, I put the sports away.
Yeah, right.
I try to do that because.
Isn't that interesting?
Because when I'm here in 17, 18, and nobody ever realized this, and I'm not complaining or anything, but I'm working 60, 70 hours a week, buzzing between high school, college, and pro sports. And then when you get home, it's like more sports, you know, because then the gambling thing. So you really have to find a balance. And I think these last 10 months, you know, getting back in the city and playing 16-inch with you guys, it's just been a lot more fun.
I love that you said the gambling thing, which, of course, is you were working for a gambling site, but it's just funny you add that in. You're like, the sports and then the gambling thing.
Well, because you're covering
nefarious.
It as a reporter, and then you're going, and now you're trying to study the gambling side, which, of course, will be legal in Illinois within the next 30 days. You're going to be able to walk into Rivers Casino in Des Plaines and bet on March Madness. I mean, that's going to happen.
I heard that they're already ready. The casinos are ready.
There's a bar in the casino. It's like a sports book bar. You could literally go there, and they're ready to just turn the switch on.
They just have the plastic over it waiting, right?
No, the bar's there. You can drink at the bar. You just can't bet at the bar yet, and they're going to have a full-on book. This will be like Vegas. Hmm. Interesting.
Okay, so let's talk a little sports. This has been an area that time, you know, right after the NBA All-Star game, but besides, I think, one Blackhawks game, it was kind of like a sports drought, meaning there was no spring training yet and the Bears weren't doing anything. It was just this moment. Now it's starting to pick up. Today, let's start with the news today that the Blackhawks at the deadline. This was a question of whether or not they were going to be buyers or sellers, if they were going to make a move towards the playoffs, if they were going to bolster their lineups, which they have in the past. But today, Gustafson, the vibe was he was gone. But it was surprising. Robin Lehner, who's the star goalie who came from the Islanders in the offseason, he was supposed to be the patch that was going to take us to the playoffs. He gone. Like, he is out for not a lot in return. Are you surprised by this move?
I'm not really. It just means that they weren't going to pay him in free agency, because Lehner has been very vocal about this was sort of that chance for him to reinvigorate himself and make him some money down the road. Like, his next contract is probably his last big contract. And it looks like, and it feels like, Stan and company just aren't going to pay him, because you're talking about, you know, maybe a 3-4 year deal. He wanted probably more. He's going to want a lot of money, and the Hawks are probably saying, look, we'll give you two at, I don't know, 15, 16.
If they even wanted to, right.
Well, I think he's the better goalie in the next. That's the funny thing, because it's like, oh, Corey Crawford, he's got two cups. Corey Crawford is on the 17th hole, man. It's almost over there. And that's not a knock on Corey Crawford. He's played a lot of hockey.
Right.
There have been some issues on and off the ice. He's battled with a lot of stuff. And you look at the calendar, and guess what? December 31st next year, he's going to be 35 years old. So over the next 3 years, is Corey Crawford going to take you to the playoffs? Maybe he's got one more run in him, but Robin Lehner will be the better goalie over the next five.
But overall, they didn't add much, except for some
future
pieces.
Well, because his stock, like, he hasn't been playing that well recently.
But my point being, for the team that had a disastrous trip through Canada, find themselves on the outside of the playoffs looking in. This was not where they were supposed to be. And you were, as a fan, saying, okay, I want to bolster that lineup. We want to see what we can do. But this from the management says, okay, we're not who we think we are?
I guess that's what it is. It's sort of sad, because this will be, what, 3 years now without the playoffs? And you have still 3 or 4 Hall of Fame players on that roster. So they're very top-heavy, and those guys, you know, Taves and Kane, make a lot of money, and that has sort of made it very hard over the last 5 years. But, I mean, you just go back, and I flip to the 2015 Blackhawks roster. I'm just going to read some names off of guys they don't have anymore. Brian Bickell, gone. Philip Dano, gone. Ryan Hartman, Nicholas Jalmerson. We know Marian Hossa is gone. Marcus Kruger. I'm talking about the core guys, the depth guys. You know, your Patrick Sharps, he retires. You got Saad back. You lost Tara Vinen, and you lost Van Riemsdyk. So they haven't been able to balance the checkbook, because they're writing big checks for, you know, the heavy hitters. But when you pay those guys that much money and a hard salary cap, you really got to do a good job of developing and keeping players. And they've made some bad trades. They've made some bad signings. Since they win the Cup in 15, it's all been downhill.
And they can do that because they won the Cup. They won three of them.
They won three. Yeah,
let's not forget that. Yeah, right.
No, I know, but that's where you are right now.
Right.
And if you look at the standings, they're actually closer to the last place team than they are to the first place team.
What does that mean for the coach, for Coach Culleton? Do you wonder about, because the move was, okay, this is going to be a different style. This is more contemporary hockey. This is not what Coach Q is bringing us. We're going to bring it together. But the team hasn't gotten better. And maybe it's a personnel thing, there's no doubt about it, but it doesn't seem like they're playing out of their skin for this coach.
And guess who has more points right now? The Florida Panthers have more points than the Chicago Blackhawks with Joel Quenneville, right? So it's almost like you don't know what you got till it's gone. It's tough, because the league is just really caught up to them. And they have been. I mean, that hard salary cap in hockey, it makes it so hard.
They can't be the only team, though.
No, they're not.
Because look at the – I mean, Boston is at the top of the standings every single year. They've got big salaries they got to pay. So what is it that – why we keep going back to the idea that you got to pay these two guys and they're a lot of money, so
no,
we're going to
no,
be
you're
mediocre.
Right. But it starts – I mean, you have to have the puck, and they don't – that sounds so simplistic, right? Oh, you should have the puck. But when they were rolling – they had four lines. They had depth. They had four or five really good defensemen. They always had the puck. If you went to a Blackhawks game, and I covered them for 6 years, it's a 60-minute game. They had the puck for 35, 40 minutes. Now you go to a Blackhawks game, and the D-men, like, they can't control the blue line. They're firing passes in the middle of the ice. They're getting picked. They're chasing the puck. They have the puck, yeah, you know, right. 25 minutes a game now, and they're always, I feel like they're always on the wrong end of the attack. Back in the day, they were just, it was like a yo-yo. It was on a string, and they made tape-to-tape passes, and they were crisp, and they were deep, and they did everything they had to do. It's not that the effort isn't there. I just think, stylistically, the league has caught up. Teams have changed their system, because the Blackhawks sort of revolutionized the game with the way Q had them playing, but now everybody else is doing the same thing, so it comes down to your depth, and they're just not a deep hockey team, and they're not a good defensive team.
I'm always surprised if I miss a game or I just see the box score, and I'll see how they play in the third period and how many goals they give up. I think it was the Rangers game not too long ago, or maybe one of those Canadian games where they have five goals in the third. Like, that's just so not what we remember about the Blackhawks. The Blackhawks were such a shutdown team. Corey Crawford was making plays at the end of games, and you were winning games 3-2 or close. The idea of giving up that many goals in the third, it blows my mind.
For so many years, we were so lucky to have, and just think about this when they're on the ice. Duncan Keith and Brent Seabrook as a pairing. Those are both Hall of Fame defenders. And then your second pairing on defense is Johnny Oduya and Nicholas Hjalmarsson. Not Hall of Famers, but Hjalmarsson's in the Hall of Very Damn Good. And then, oh, by the way, behind him, here's an in-his-prime Corey Crawford. Yeah, they scored a lot of goals, but they had the puck, and they kept you out of their zone. I saw Steve Conrad say this the other day on television, or I heard him say it. They've given up the most shots in the league.
Mm.
That's nuts. Thinking about where they were to where they are.
They had some injuries this year, and you think about, because I remember in the free agency, in the offseason, they tried to bolster their defense. They obviously see that as an issue. Sam Panayotovich is here. We're talking sports tonight, Blackhawks. I want to make a transition, talk about spring training, and I want to talk about the Bulls. A lot of rumors coming out of the NBA that this is the twilight for Gar Pax, or at least Gar Foreman. We'll see.
All right.
It's Sam Panayotovich at 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here with Sam Panayotovich, the great sports guy here in Chicago. And we've had these conversations on the show before, and it's kind of felt like a good gut check time to talk sports, because everyone has issues, each one of our teams, and we'll try to get through all of them. But 312 or texter asks about, is it possible that the Chicago Bulls would change GMs midseason? We saw coming out of the All-Star break, it was such a celebration of the NBA and Chicago. Not a lot of mention of the Bulls. The only thing that came out of that was a report that the Bulls were looking to make a change.
How about when First Take was at the United Center and Zach LaVine is being interviewed, Bulls superstar Zach LaVine, who's the only good player on this team every single night. He's on the set with, I think, Stephen A. Smith and Max Kellerman, and the fire guard packs national television. This is leaking out over the air. So that's sort of where we're at right now. And I, you know, you and I joke all the time. We have this conversation every single time we talk. Hey, are they going to fix the Bulls? I don't think they would fire him in season, because I always come back when I think about Jerry Reinsdorf. He's very godfatherish and he's very loyal, and he never wants to make you look bad unless you cross him. And he had no problem kicking Tom Thibodeau to the curb and, you know, making a statement because Thibodeau crossed the line in his eyes. As long as you toe the company line and you take the beating that you deserve and don't kick it up, you're fine. Mm. I think Gar Foreman, I think he's walking the plank at the end of the season. But I don't even think they're going to fire him. They'll probably just promote him to an advisor or something.
I had an agent in during the NBA All-Star Weekend, and we were talking about what free agents look for, and he said front office and culture. Right, they talk about culture. And you see in Toronto, or you see, I'm trying to think, even in the Clippers organization, management change, even ownership change, at some point where they flip the script, they start anew, and it changes course. The idea that I've heard now that John Paxson or Gar Foreman and are going to stay with the organization, they're going to be removed from John, they're going to get a new GM, but they're going to move the scout, and they're going to move John Paxson over here, and there's going to be a whole thing. It doesn't sound like that's a culture change. That just sounds like they're rearranging the the check.
The chairs on the Titanic?
Yeah, right, that's what I was
going to ask. It's the USS. Uh-oh.
Right. Yeah. You know what I mean, though? If you're changing, how is it possible GM comes in and goes, I think we should do this, and over in the corner you've got two guys in scouting going, I wouldn't do that.
That's Paxson has, you know, when he needs to take the reins, he just jumps in, and, you know, it's like say you and I are, you know, our families are having Easter, right? And you do all the work. But the last 10 minutes, it's like, no, you know what? I'm going to take over, and I made the ham, and I'm going to slice. Wait a minute. You did, you know, your job. You're having us all over. It's your meal. You're making the food. And then at the end, I'm like, I'm going to take over. That's what happens when you have a guy like that in power. He's never going to be completely out of the equation. It's sort of like Kenny Williams with the White Sox.
It's very like Kenny Williams.
You know, Rick Hahn is the guy who came in, brought in analytics, believed in tearing it down, you know, digging the tree out of the ground and planting a new tree. That's what Rick Hahn did. But Kenny Williams, like, every time the Sox are around 500, Kenny Williams struts out, you know, he's like, you know, anybody, hey, he's on the field, and, you know, people ask him questions and he still answers, but he's not the day-to-day guy anymore. You know, when GMs call to make a trade, they don't call Kenny Williams. They call Rick Hahn. So Paxson will always be there in some capacity. That's just the way it is. So a new GM has to know that,
yeah.
Guess what? Like, you may be the GM, but you're not in total control.
If a new GM comes in, and this is a big, it'd be after the season, would it be a snap of the fingers that they would say goodbye to the coach there, that they would move on from some of the players that have been wearing the jerseys in the last couple years?
I don't even know how you can bring this guy back. I don't know. And there were rumors that he signed this long extension, and of course we don't know the terms and the amount. It's goofy, but does he inspire any confidence in you? And you're a bigger basketball fan than you let on. When you see that guy, does he inspire any confidence in you?
The move he made in Toronto, and it's didn't get a lot of play, and he's done this a couple times this year, that he's drawn my ire, is he did the move in Toronto where he took the timeout with a minute to play, down 20, as a moment to draw up a play on Super Bowl Sunday. And Toronto had blown them out. It was up in Toronto. It was maybe a 20-point lead. And he stopped the game. And the Toronto broadcaster, I think it was a radio, Pete played it for me, was like, what's going on here? Like, he actually was like, I'm trying to get out of the building. What is this guy doing? And it's just when broadcasters, when pundits, when players, they all are scratching their head at the moves that the one guy is making. It's hard to look away. It's hard to say, no, I believe in this guy, because it just constantly seems to be a head scratcher.
And when he was a head coach in college, you and I talked about this last time we did our, you know, Bulls conversation after Christmas. When he was a head coach in college, he was a maniac. Think Bobby Knight at Indiana. Just rawr! And now it's like, I use the joke, it's almost like somebody took a piece of his brain out. He's like a different guy.
You realize you can't do that. You get kicked out.
Right, but he is so nice now. And when his team blew that 28-point lead, they were up, I can't remember who they played. This is right before you and I talked, so it had to be December. Yeah. They lost a 28-point lead, and he was like, well, I was proud of the way we fought. And it's just, it's the opposite. You were fighting, and then you stopped fighting because you lost a 28-point lead.
Yeah.
It's like he doesn't even know what's going on.
It was that, and there was the other one where he talked about they had a win, and he talked about how Markkanen was taking his coaching, and now he's finding out where he's supposed to be in this system. And that was really infuriating to me, because I'm like, this kid was close to a rookie of the year. If he wasn't, I can't remember if he was. But the idea that before Jim Boylan came to the Bulls, he was finding his shot, and he was on, you know, superstar level, meaning the ascension was there. The other players in the NBA knew it. The coaches knew it. Now it's about him finding a spot in Jim Boylan's system. What?
He was trending upward, up and to the right, up and to the right. Now he's down and to the left. That's the way he's trending right now, and his points are down, his shots are down, his free throw attempts, everything is down. And, of course, now he's hurt. He's only played 46 games this year, and we might not see him again the rest of the year. And there were these rumors sort of trickling out that, you know, he's not going to come back if this coaching staff doesn't change. That was reported. I don't know that that's all. I mean, there are a lot of things that get blasted on social media. Now, you know, you know a guy,
bunch,
I know a guy.
Right.
That's the perfect word for it. They're dysfunctional. From top to bottom, and now the attendance numbers are starting to go down. And that when that happens, that's when you're going to see the people upstairs, because for years they still printed tickets. They were number one in attendance from, God, 88 to 2012. They were number one in the league in attendance, and now they're nowhere near that.
One of the things we saw at the NBA All-Star Week was this love of Chicago basketball, and a lot of the stars, the superstars in the league, talking with warm affection for Chicago. Maybe not the Bulls, but Chicago. One of the players, and you sent this to me, was Jimmy Butler, talking about what Chicago means to him and one day hoping to come back to the Bulls organization. That's another head-scratcher. I can never see that happening with the current management.
I actually sent that to you and to Pete. That's how Florida was. I had to send it to two people to make sure that you both had it. That's interesting, because Jimmy still has several homes in Chicago. He loves Chicago, and in the summertime, he's either working out in Los Angeles or he's hanging out in Chicago. And have you seen the fish tank, by the way? He's got that fish tank boombox in his living room. That he loves. Jimmy Butler loves Jimmy
Butler.
But
he's the kind of player, you're seeing it. He did it in Philadelphia, where he took him to the, he made them, they lost on a Kawhi Leonard last minute shot, or they'd be talking about championships.
And look what they've done with the Miami
Heat. And then
Heat.
Here he is with the Heat. He's a bona fide superstar. Even in Minnesota, where he didn't have the greatest run, he got that team to the playoffs for the first time in 10 years or whatever. He's a superstar, and it still baffles me that he got shipped out of town.
And the Bulls, when they got rid of him, said that they couldn't, essentially, they didn't say this, but when you trade Jimmy Butler, you're admitting that you can't win with Jimmy Butler, that at that time, at that place, they weren't ready to do it. But look what the Miami Heat have done. It's amazing what culture can do. You used the word culture earlier. Pat Riley, Eric Spoelstra. Championship culture. Older players want to go there. Young players develop there. They get better there. They continuously grow as players. It doesn't happen here.
So what do you think about this Bulls team? Are we going to be dancing around the idea of a seventh overall
pick? They pick seventh again. Holy cow.
Is that where we're at? I mean, or do you think there's a chance this team could go on a run and actually fight for that eighth seed in the playoffs?
The schedule doesn't get much better. The last quarter of the schedule is arguably
playing the Bucks every third game.
Every day, actually. Yeah, they just play the Bucks. Bucks are 49-8, by the way. And they've also leapt. I mean, all these teams in the Eastern Conference have leapt the Bulls in the last couple of years. They're 20-38, so they're 58 games in. You got 24 more to go with this mess. I've got them probably winning in 24 games. I'd make the over under 7.5 wins. That's where I'd put it. It's just, it is what it is. I wish they, you know what though? I wish they'd go 0-24.
Yeah, at least be in the lottery.
And just pick first or second. I mean, how many years could they have had Luka? Would you like Luka Doncic as a Bull? Or do you want Wendell Carter? If you can tank right and lose right and go up the draft, you're not picking seventh, you're picking second.
I don't understand what would happen with Kobe White. I thought that he, at the beginning of the year, I thought this kid was supposed to be, we all got the vibe he'd be playing in the Rising Stars. He was going to be a Rookie of the Year type. He had the big hair and he was hitting threes. He just disappeared. What happened?
He's 20 years old, first of all. He's a little guy, 6'4", 180, maybe. I think that's with his whole uniform on. I think he's 180 pounds. So he needs to put on muscle. I think conditioning, strength-wise, he needs to be better. But remember, he's a 20-year-old kid in his first year of basketball playing for a bad coach.
All right.
A lot of those things are bad. It's a bad situation when you're not big enough, you're not strong enough, you're 20, and your coach, by the way, doesn't know what he's doing.
Sam Panionovich is here. All right, coming up. Let's talk White Sox.
Baseball. Oh, I'm hanging out even longer?
Yeah,
all right.
Longer.
I like this.
Because I want to talk about the White Sox, because I remember at the end of last year, and this doesn't get talked about a lot, when they were playing in September and no one was really paying attention, they had fun. You saw them in the dugout. Aloy Jimenez is a little jokester. They're throwing Gatorade on themselves. They were loose, and that seems to be carrying over to spring training, and that's exciting. Sam Panionovich with us here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Sammy Panionovich here, WGN Radio 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're talking about sports, and we're going to turn our attention to the baseball teams in town. Spring training in the Cactus League is underway, and let's start with our Chicago White Sox. We, of course, a flagship. I couldn't be prouder to be a part of the organization that brings you my favorite team. The White Sox usually don't have a lot of buzz around them in spring training. I think that's why you see a lot of White Sox fans having smiles on their faces, right? I mean, that's really what it is. There hasn't been buzz. Even when Ozzie took them to the World Series, there wasn't a lot of buzz around that spring training. It wasn't until they jumped out of the gate and they actually had success in the. So it's not, we're not used to the kind of buzz we're getting this year.
Remember the 04 White Sox, the 3-4-5 in that lineup, Frank Thomas, Maglio Ordóñez, and Carlos Lee.
Yeah.
And going in the 05, Ordóñez was gone.
Lee was gone.
Lee was shipped out for Scott Podsednik, who was their leadoff hitter, and Frank was hurt all year.
And he was disgruntled. He wasn't happy about the whole thing.
I'm stunned by that.
Yeah.
I'm stunned by Frank Thomas really being upset.
It's funny. The history gets rewritten, because he's a Hall of Famer, and everyone's like, oh, what a great, loyal White Sox. Half the time he was mad at the team.
You've got to get, I'm telling you right now, Pete, write this down. You've got to get Joe Colley on. And when Joe Colley was covering the White Sox with Frank Thomas and Tony Phillips, he said he'd never been more scared in his life than having to go into a scrum with Tony Phillips or Frank Thomas after a bad game.
I forgot Phillips was on the team.
Oh, Tony. There was one story with Tony Phillips, followed a reporter to the parking lot. Yeah, over something that they had written.
You're right. Frank didn't play much at all that year. They won. That's amazing. People forget that. He gets a ring because he was on that team, but he was DL'd by May or June, I feel, and didn't play the rest of the year.
Frank Thomas in 2005 only played 34 games.
Yeah.
And not anything in the playoffs either. But you're right. Back to your original point.
The buzz.
The 05 team didn't have this hype going into it. Let me put it this way. I've been going to opening day on the South Side. My dad took us every year we could go. I probably had my first opening day when I was 2 years old and don't even remember it. 30 years old now, I've probably been to 25 opening days as a reporter and as a fan. I've never been this excited than I am right now. I mean, they're oozing with optimism. They're confident, but it's not arrogance. It's a fun swagger. And if you look at their social media, with all these, with Moncada, doing the salsa dance on Instagram. And, he's handsome, by the way. I might slide into the DMs. I mean, they're just building this fun buzz around them. And when you supplement that with the offseason haul, when you bring in guys like Yasmani Grandal, who many around baseball think he's one of the best defensive catchers, you bring in a Cy Young winner who will teach these young pitchers how to come every day and prepare and bring it every start. Dallas Keuchel, of course. Encarnacion, he's 35 years old, but I mean,
you had a great year last year.
You're full of young Latin players, and who better than an old Latin veteran to go on the road and hang out on the buses and the planes and in the hotel rooms?
He was leading people. I know that I keep hearing that, the old timer. He was considered to be an old timer at the beginning of last year in Seattle. By the time they traded him to New York, he was leading the home run chase. He was up in the leaders. There, towards the end, he faded out. But the point being, he didn't play like a 34-year-old last year.
He's 30, actually 37. But
or 36-year-old last year.
He has hit 414 home runs in his career. I don't care if he hits 20 or 30. His impact in that locker room, and I'm a big fan of the culture and the chemistry in a locker room, that guy is going to bring those young players to another level.
Yeah.
Just with the wisdom, with the film study, with the knowledge of how to hit major league pitching, because a lot of, Luis Robert, he's never seen a major league pitch before. You think it'll help to have a 37-year-old vet who speaks the language and knows the culture? It's a huge deal. There's a reason he's here.
One of the other names that rarely gets mentioned with all the talent is Eloy Jimenez, who last year was rookie of the year candidate, hit 30 home runs, and he had a shortened season with some injuries. But he had a big problem because they were going to throw him nothing all year. You remember that was a big thing. They just were like, chase it, rookie. And he was. If you get a guy like Encarnacion who's around who can teach him how to essentially go from where he was to the next level, and he's not got all the pressure on him that everybody's looking at him, and whenever Eloy Jimenez came up, boy, man, I just think that that's a good recipe.
It's a big deal, and I go back to the 2014 Cubs when they started to flip, good trade. Well, actually, take it back to 2012 when they flip Andrew Kashner for Anthony Rizzo. But in 14, that's when they sort of went full steam ahead. And then by 2015, they brought in John Lester, David Ross, Miguel Montero, and there's one more, Dexter Fowler. So they bring all those guys in, and it sort of changed things. You're like, wow, this is a real team with real good guys that know how to win, and those guys are teaching the young kids. And then in 2016, what did they do? They signed Ben Zobrist and they signed Jason Hayward. So you bring those six guys that we just brought up, and you add them to a team full of blossoming young players with endless talent. It's a pretty serious mix. Mm. It's a pretty serious mix.
Where are they weak? I mean, because everyone says, oh, this is a good third-place team.
Defensively, I have my concerns defensively, and my heart drops every time Eloy Jimenez runs back to the warning track. Remember, I thought he broke his leg last year trying to rob a home run.
He does not look very graceful.
Not very graceful. And now you're asking Luis Robert, your rookie center fielder, who, by the way, has never seen a major league pitch, to pretty much hold down not only center field, but, hey, you got the alleys, too. Because if you put Eloy in left and Nomar Mazara in right,
yeah,
they're not gold glovers by any means. So outfield defense for me is an issue. The back end of the rotation, I don't know what Dylan Cease and Reynaldo Lopez are yet. I'm optimistic. So I'd say the outfield defense, the back of the rotation, and still some guys in that bullpen I'm not so sure. And they got some good guys, Colomay, and Aaron Bummer to me is an outstanding reliever.
They signed him, yeah.
And that's a great move, and he's a very, very good pitcher, very effective sinker, and throws it at 98 miles an hour. It's tough to hit. But there are still 6th, 7th, and 8th inning guys that I don't know that I want the ball. But you got some young arms in the minors, and maybe Michael Kopech is a bullpen guy. Maybe Carlos Rodon is a bullpen guy. We'll see how it plays out. But those would be the three biggest concerns: outfield defense, back end of the rotation, and the bullpen.
Okay, so who leads off for this team? That's my concern. I thought it was going to be Luis Robert, but you're right. He hasn't seen a major league pitch.
I don't want him to lead off, because if he goes like Robin Ventura-esque and goes 0-41, I mean, where is he going to be mentally? You know, you don't want him to lead off. I think Anderson will probably get first crack. I think that's probably the way it goes.
I read somewhere that Tim Anderson's walk ratio is off the charts, the worst in baseball.
He doesn't walk.
It just makes him so much more interesting. He won the batting title. People forget that. He's the best hitter in the American League, and he walked 10 times. That's startling, because most of the time, guys who are hitting 330, they walk 100 times because they know they're waiting for their pitch. The idea that Tim Anderson walked 10 times, or whatever it is, 15, the idea he did that, and he still won the batting title, that's just insane talent.
I don't like to get too numbery when I talk baseball, because people just go, ugh, you know, they don't like the advanced metrics. I'm not going to tell you what his VORP or his BLORP was, but I can tell you this. His batting average last year, Tim Anderson, was .335. His on-base percentage was .357.
Yeah, that's not good.
It's only 22 points higher than his batting average. That's insane. You never see stuff like that. He came on and said, look, I don't care. I'm not going to walk. I hit the ball. The guy's got swag. Did you go to Sox Fest, by the way? He was teaching six-year-olds how to flip their bat. There was a Tim Anderson bat-flipping seminar.
Hey, the question I asked this to all Sox fans, and I hear the, oh, yeah, well, it's all process. But I'm like, if not now, when? Because the Cleveland Indians, who have dominated this division for years, completely fire sale this week, and Corey Kluber got traded, which is to me a sign of we're rebuilding. The Minnesota Twins are, you could put them into a category that they were a fluke because they hit home runs like crazy, but they don't really have, and they get bounced every year in the first round. And then the Royals and the Tigers are way out. So it feels to me that there's something in the recipe that if the Sox play with the kind of confidence and swagger we're talking about, they could be in the playoff race.
If they have some players have career years, and some of these pitchers like Giolito and Keuchel, and I don't know about Gio Gonzalez, if Giolito and Keuchel and Cease, if those three have above average years, and you get 30 home runs from Eloy Jimenez and Yoan Moncada's in the MVP running, and you know Aaron Bummer and Colomay are locking it down in the ninth inning, and Luis Robert is as good as people believe he can be. If all those things go right and everything goes right for this team, they can win the division. They could win 90 games. It's not out of the stretch of possibility. It really isn't. The Twins are the best team. But in a 162-game season, a lot of stuff happens.
Yeah. Baseball-wise, today was the first day, and I shouldn't laugh, but today was the first day that Jose Altuve was pegged.
First pitch. You can bet on this, by the way. Did you know that?
Really?
You can bet on how many times the Astros will be hit this year.
The Houston Astros, of course, involved in the cheating scandal. And there are questions about whether or not this will derail their season because many of the players are mad at him. The first pitch. So what does that mean? Are we going to? Is it going to be the kind of thing where the Astros are going to get hit every time they come up?
I kind of hope so, actually. I mean, I don't like those guys. They cheated in the World Series, you know? I get that, you know, if Rob Manfred comes out and says, you know, if you throw at the Astros on purpose, they just cheated in the World Series, and none of the guys had any repercussions. Like, the team had to pay a $5 million fine, which they'll make up in one homestand, and they lost some draft picks. Sweet. Like, nothing really, none of those players.
Do you
players,
think they go back and change it?
I don't think so.
Do you think that Manfred goes, you know what, I made a mistake, Altuve, Springer, Correa, you guys are all in a year suspension?
I think it's very unlikely, but I would ban that team for 2 years from the postseason. That's what I would do.
Yeah, or that. What, couldn't Manfred say, hey, you know what, we made a call before this opening day, you guys are not in contention.
How many times have we seen that in college basketball or college football when a team...
Do they not want to do that because they're afraid that people won't come watch the games?
I don't know what it is. I mean, there are so many questions I have with the whole situation, and I still don't know what exactly happened. I mean, we know they were getting signs, but did they have buzzers? Was it the signal on the scoreboard? I mean, we've heard many variations. We know they were cheating, but do we know the extent? Do we know how many other teams do it? I mean, there was this report on The Athletic that the Astros are one of 8 teams that were doing this.
The one part of that story that I still don't think you connect the dots on is managers and players were calling their friends who were in the World Series saying that, watch out, the Astros cheat. The Yankees knew they were cheating. The Dodgers knew. Everyone knew they were cheating. The Nationals, Davey Martinez, knew they were cheating. But nobody seemed to tell or whistleblow on it. No one seemed. So it makes me think that it was much more, like you said, 8 teams, that everyone knew that it was happening, and there's a no-snitch policy in the MLB, well, which is weird. It's just weird to be like, why are we on the hook as fans to be mad about it when they're all complicit in it?
And everything points back, for me, to the 90s, the late 90s specifically, when you knew, I mean, you could just go to a game and know that half these guys are on juice. I mean, these guys were Jason Giambi in 2001. Holy crap. I mean, he had muscles on his muscles. I mean, they were all taking steroids. And, like, the best, Barry Bonds is taking steroids. So, and then the crazy part about that is, after the hitters all started doing it, then the pitchers were like, oh, screw this. You know, I'm going to.
Roger Clemens, right.
I mean, Eric Gagne was throwing 102 miles an hour in the Dodger book. So, like, the hitters were all taking roids. So then the pitchers all started taking roids. And, like, the league just couldn't figure it out. How do you not figure out the cheating thing? I just don't know. So many things have happened in baseball over the years where it looks so obvious and it feels so weird. But the league office is always the last to figure it out.
The other part, and I looked it up because someone made reference to that the Yankees, and I remember this game, I think it was the NL or ALCS, that they started barking at each other in the first inning of maybe the first game where the Yankees and the Astros benches got into it. And there was like some coaches that were yelling. And I went back and I looked it up, and it was the Yankees beat reporters talking about, well, they were concerned that they thought that the Astros were stealing signs and using technology to do so. I mean, it's right there in plain in the New York Post. And that's the thing that we didn't learn about it for 3 months later, and they blame it on a whistleblower pitcher from who used to pitch with the Astros when they were all reporting it in November. It was an unguarded secret. And I don't understand. Everybody in the league thought it was fine until it wasn't.
The way I picture this actually going down, how it went down, I picture, you know, Rob Manfred in his office, you know, he's sitting there with his, you know, his little sweatsuit on or whatever, and, you know, they hand over a couple of, hey, Commissioner, you should probably watch these tapes. He's like, yeah, I'll get to it, and he throws them in a pile while he watches reruns of the Three Stooges on his TV. You know, like, he like just didn't care, didn't want to know.
The end of the piece said that the Astros had been accused of this, and the Astros and Manfred had said there's no, they didn't even look into it. That's what the end of this piece was.
I know.
Wow. All right.
I don't get it.
Sam Benyanovich is here. I got to take a break. Let's take a break, and then we'll talk about the Cubs. How about that?
Do we have to?
We don't have to. We can do the Bears. We can skip the Cubs.
No, we can do the Cubs.
All right. Stay with us. Sam Benyanovich is here, 720 WGN. We're talking Chicago sports, getting an update tonight. It seems like I had on my list all these things to talk about. College basketball is another one I want to talk about. So maybe we do quick on the Cubs, do a little. We got about 6 minutes here. So Cubs, Chris Bryant leading off. That's really the big story coming out of Cubs camp.
That's the plan. Let's put our two best RBI men, 1 and 2, and see what happens. So the reports are that they're looking, you know, Bryant 1 and Rizzo 2, and then some formation of Baez, Schwarber, Contreras 3-4-5. I think they're going to sort of figure that out. But I get you want your best players to have the most at bats, but I feel like if they just moved everybody down one peg and found a leadoff hitter, that would make way much more sense.
Yeah, right. Well, and I think Joe Maddon got a bad rap. He was always trying to put Kyle Schwarber there, and where everyone said that, oh, that's bad managing. And then Rossi comes in there like, how about Bryant? It's like, what are you talking about?
Bryant walks, he gets on base. You know, the power numbers have dwindled a little bit over the last couple of years.
I don't know.
It's interesting, man.
He's a Nolan Arenado MVP caliber third baseman. Seems weird to me to lead him off.
So Bryant's home run numbers, he had 26 when he was a rookie, 39 the second year, 29, 13, and then last year he actually had more than I thought, 31. He walked 74 times last year, only stole four bases, so he's a station-to-station guy on the base paths. They've been searching for Dexter Fowler ever since they let Dexter Fowler go, and I find no coincidence that the offense hasn't been as good without a true leadoff hitter.
Yeah. Javi Baez came out last week, and he said that the team wasn't really prepared to play last year, that they were not getting loose, that they weren't ready until the fourth inning in some games, and this year it's going to be different. How do you view that?
It sounds like BS to me, honestly, because I forget the outlet that had all the numbers about when they scored, what innings they scored in. And actually, the first two innings were their best innings as far as runs scored. So they scored a lot of their runs in the first and second innings. The problem was they didn't score late, and their bullpen wasn't great. So does that mean that, you know, you need to take batting practice a little more? I guess. I felt like last year, and again, I wasn't in that locker room and I wasn't around the Cubs like I'd been in years past, but it just felt like there was an entitlement there. And I think it was it was time to make a change. And I think the message went stale from the manager. We know Theo and Jed like to have power, and they want things done their way. And when you're not winning, and they won a lot of games over the last 5 years, but when you win the World Series in 16 and then sort of flame out in the NLCS in 17, you flame out in 18, and last year was a disaster. Theo and Jed decided they had to make a change.
If the Cubs go mediocre, middle of the season, hit a losing streak, find themselves 12 back, do the fans start getting angry?
They're already angry.
They get mad at Ricketts and Theo and everything, because this offseason was very unusual. They went addition by subtraction. They didn't add anybody in. They got rid of Joe Maddon, said he's the problem. Are they setting themselves up for... I mean, that was amazing to watch people booing. I mean, it's obviously about their Cubs network, but booing their owner that brought him a World Series.
Cub fans are a different breed, man. They really are. I know some Cub fans that hate watch, and they like when they lose, it's like, oh, they all suck. And I'm like, you guys realize you just had probably the best 5-year window you're ever going to have,
and most baseball teams will never get there. Yeah.
What if they don't win it again for another 100 years? You know, I mean, it's amazing to me. I mean, big picture, they ran Joe Maddon out of town 3 years after he won a World Series. To me, that makes no sense. But that's just the world we live in now. You want. And when they win a World Series, it's like, not enough. We got to win another one, and you got to win the third one after that. And it's just the expectations, I feel like, are so impossible on the north side sometimes. Yeah. And when they win the World Series in 2016 and everybody's ecstatic that has grown up and the families and dads and grandfathers and, you know, everybody's all in. And then in 2017, they missed the playoffs, and it's like, fire Theo! You know, like, are you out of your mind? You know? I never understand how some Cub fans are warped that way, where unless it's, like, every year it was wait till next year, and you were in this year for, like, 3-4 years,
yeah,
and you
tough.
Still weren't happy.
And they were, and even 2019, they were in it towards the end. They just fell apart. All right. Let's skip the Bears, although the combine's coming up here, and they dropped a couple of players. Prince Amukamara and Taylor Gabriel just kind of get quietly dropped before the March 1st deadline. College basketball, I want to get to, because we just have 3 minutes here. The real deal on Illinois? I mean, they have a shot here to make some noise and actually be the team in the tournament?
I think they can make a run. I think they can go Sweet 16, Elite 8, but they'll be even better next year, assuming Coburn, the big center from Jamaica, stays. He's 7'2", 90, but he still like doesn't know what he's doing because he hasn't played basketball that long. He's just like there, right? Like he doesn't know how
to play. My favorite college basketball player. How do you do this?
Well, he just jumps and like you think he's gonna rip the backboard off the post, you know? But he's still very raw and like he's still learning how to play basketball. And Io, we'll see if he goes pro or not. DeSumo, the kid from Morgan Park. But if those two come back, the team is going to be next year. That's going to be the team to beat. But they can win a couple tournament games, maybe go to a Sweet 16 or an Elite Eight.
Will they be the only Illinois team represented in the March Madness?
They're going to be the Paul.
Are you surprised that they fell apart like that? I mean, the Big East is tough, man.
They were 12-1. They are 14-13. They are 2-12 in conference. You hate to see it, and that hurts in recruiting because now players are seeing this, and they're like, ugh, do I really want to go there? Northwestern, meow, we know the deal there. I don't want to get in trouble. Dave Ennett's probably listening. They're not going to the tournament. Loyola, they win the Missouri Valley. Same with Illinois State. You know, we'll see what happens there. But Illinois, for sure, they're back to being the best team in Illinois.
DePaul, they had such a great start. I will say that the Big East is a lot tougher than you think. Villanova, Seton Hall is actually a possible number one seed. The Butler Bulldogs out of Indianapolis, another team that is going to be a high seed. I mean, they have some serious teams in the Big East. I was surprised. This is not the year for DePaul to be making a run. It's like they needed one of those years where everyone was mediocre, but it's not
DePaul
the case.
Thought DePaul only trained for a half marathon. They didn't train for the whole marathon. They stopped about halfway through. It's really hard to start a season that well and then completely do the. They were 9-0. They were 12-1. 14-13. That's very hard to do.
Okay, right back to the Bears.
Okay,
Tom Brady.
No, stop.
Phillip Rivers?
No.
It's nobody? Mitch Trubisky?
Mitch Trubisky. There you go. Ring the bell. Mitch Trubisky's the quarterback. And that's clear. If you don't understand that, you're just not paying attention.
Do they have enough money to make a run and change this team in any form?
No.
So there's not. So if you're a Bears fan and you're thinking, here comes free agency and all these players are out there and all these sites say, well, here'd be a good spot for a landing spot for this person ever. That's all garbage. It's just going to be the same team minus Prince Amukamara and Taylor Gabriel.
The defense should be better. They had a lot of injuries last year, and I think that sort of gets buried under how bad the offense was. But if you're a Bears fan, here's the reality. Drink a little bit more on Sunday and pray that Trubisky can win you some more games. It starts and it ends with the quarterback. Look at the NFC-AFC championship games. Look at the quarterbacks. Mahomes, Tannehill, Rodgers, Garoppolo. They're all pretty good. You got to have a quarterback to make that next.
What I would say, too, which was very alarming, is that it was the running game for all those teams. Look what the San Francisco 49ers ran themselves into the Super Bowl. The Tennessee Titans almost ran themselves into the Super Bowl. The Bears running game was atrocious. What a terrible for to watch those teams do what Bears fans have seen the Bears do for years, run the ball, and then this year to say we don't run the ball, that's not what the NFL does. Obviously that was wrong.
Right. Obviously, was wrong. They did a lot of things poorly last year, but the quarterback has to take that next step. I mean, that's really the only way this thing gets better is if he plays better and he develops a pocket game. And by a pocket game, I mean he can stand in the pocket and hit an open target and make the deep ball throws, because the deep ball for him, I get nervous because I don't know where it's going. You know, you don't know if it's going into the stands or if it's going to a defender, or maybe the receiver will catch it. The deep ball, the pocket game has to be better. If it's not, then you're not making the playoffs.
Sammy, great to see you, buddy.
You too, man.
Sam Panionovich, we're talking sports tonight, Chicago sports. That's going to do it for us here on 720 WGN. Dane Neal is in for Nick DiGilio tonight, so Dane coming up next right after Vic's news. And we're off tomorrow night. Tomorrow night is Blackhawks. We'll be back on Wednesday with the swap meet with Greg Flamm and much, much more. So all that coming up this week. We got a short show on Thursday, and we're back on Friday as well. So signing off for the night, Justin Kaufman saying good night.